Hey, the time is now 9:31 a.m. on August 30th, and I call the meeting of the Committee on Behavior Analysts to order. The meeting is video hosted using Zoom. The public and parties on this agenda have been properly noticed of this fact and have been supplied with meeting access instructions. To kick us off this morning, Ms. Malice, would you please call roll?
Yes, Madam Chair. Dr. Byra? Dr. Byra?
Present. Can you not hear me?
I can hear you now.
Okay.
Dr. Davy?
Present.
Ms. Denton?
Present.
Dr. Rates?
Present.
And Dr. Stenhoff?
Present.
We have a quorum.
Excellent. The next agenda item is just our general committee remarks, announcements, updates. So at this point, as usual, I want to thank the members of the public who are here. It is definitely a benefit whenever our stakeholders are present and are able to see the way that this committee operates and how we put in our best efforts to ensure that the public receives safe behavior analytics services in the state of Arizona. And so as we go through that, you'll also find today that we've got a little bit of a special treat whenever we go through. And we've got a subject matter expert as a guest who will be joining the meeting today and providing us some additional information. I would also like to thank board staff for the efforts that they go through every single month, this month not excluded, in gathering the necessary information to move forward applications for licensure, to navigate any of the barriers that are anticipated before it comes to the committee level, and all of the work that they do. I think I can speak on behalf of the committee when we say thank you, board staff. So I think those are the general remarks and updates that we have. So we will go ahead and discuss continuing education credit for maintenance of BACB certification. The Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners is approved by the BACB as an ACE continuing education provider. Attending a meeting of the Board's Committee on Behavior Analysts is eligible for continuing education credit for maintenance of both BACB certification and for Arizona licensure renewal. To claim this credit, make note of the code words that will be provided hourly throughout the meeting by board staff. To report the code words to board staff for purposes of earning continuing education credit, look for the link on the board's meeting page for this particular meeting. Board staff will verify licensees earned credits for attending this meeting in their CE broker accounts. Licensees will be able to view the entered and verified credit within 2 to 3 weeks of this meeting. We will move on to agenda item number 4, which is the approval of minutes. We have minutes from July 26th of 2024. All we have are regular session minutes from this meeting. Are there any recusals for these minutes? Okay. Seeing no recusals, would anyone like to offer a motion for the July 26th regular session minutes?
So moved.
Is there a second?
One second.
Okay. The motion has been made by Dr. Stenhoff to approve the July 26th, 2024 regular session minutes. It has been seconded by Dr. Rates. Is there any discussion? Okay. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Oh, perfect. All opposed, nay. The motion carries. All right, we will move on to agenda item number 5, which is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding subject matter expert presentation concerning ARS 32-2091.0883. This is Ms. Pakkinen, as well as Dr. Davis Wilson, who regularly attends these meetings, but is actually getting to participate at this point. We've missed you so much since you have left the committee and the board. Ms. Pakkinen, would you provide an overview of Dr. Davis Wilson's presentation as we roll into this?
Yes, Madam Chair. So this topic and this subject has been featured on several committee agendas in the past. And of course, in a contextual fashion, this issue has been raised on a number of occasions, and it relates to a subsection of your exemption statute 32-2091.08. At subsection A3, a matriculated graduate, this is a exemption for licensure, a matriculated graduate student or a trainee whose activities are part of a defined behavior analyst program of study, so forth. This is a topic that, it, as it happens, Dr. Davis Wilson has done an extensive amount of, you know, research and outreach around this topic. And so it made some sense that we bring her forward to share with the committee and to present to anyone who is attending as a stakeholder, you know, what information that she has gathered relative to this statute. I think the committee would really like to hear from our expert about a holistic analysis of this language and, you know, how the board or how the committee may construe it and apply it to some different situations and scenarios that present where applications and where complaints are concerned. So with that, I will let Dr. Davis Wilson take over the presentation. You should have free rein to share your screen, but let me know if I did not set that properly. Okay, very good.
I think that is going to work. Let me turn on the presentation. Are we good? Does that look good for everybody? All right. Thank you guys so much for having me. I'm excited to be here. This happens to be a topic near and dear to my heart. It's one of my favorite topics to talk about. I talk to a lot of businesses around the nation. Actually, this is an interest that is not just specific to Arizona's conversations, but there's other licensing boards, other professional associations, and then just general practitioners that are interested in this topic or similar topics as well. So I greatly appreciate you guys considering me and inviting me to join today to go over this and to kind of give some historical perspective, some kind of language, more traditional kind of medical practice, billing type stuff, and then just kind of how everything kind of speaks to the ethics codes, because I did crosswalk both ethics codes, the old and the new, as well as the statute. So I'm going to just go through the, I'm trying to make sure that if there's questions and stuff, I can see everybody, but I am, oh, sorry. Oh, I'm pushing a lot of buttons. I'm going to go through the presentation. Likely not going to be able to see anybody. So if you guys have questions and want to raise your hand, well, don't raise your hand, speak out, let me know. I am going to go through.
I'll make sure that I'm attending to hands.
Perfect.
Attention to that. So I got you covered.
Excellent. I appreciate that. I am going to go through this in the most logical order that I could come up with, but it does bounce around a little bit. And so I do apologize for that. There's a lot, just a lot in context, and it's hard to kind of match all of the pieces together. So if you, you know, are confused or want to ask questions, please feel free to do so. Otherwise, I'm hoping to get through this rather quickly so that there is room for question and answer kind of discussion as you guys, however you guys need. So I will go ahead and kind of get started. Maybe see, I'm delaying because I can't figure out my buttons. All right. I offer this disclaimer to everybody. I know it's a little bit more obvious in this setting, but I am not an attorney. I am passionate about consumer protection. I am passionate about supervision and quality training and I am passionate about public policy. And so I spend a lot of time in this area, but at the end of the day, I am not a funder. I am not a lawyer. I do not work for any of the state entities. And as a result, I do recommend that at any time you need questions answered, that everything does go through legal advice. So I had the opportunity to, I've been in multiple meetings, obviously. I do like these meetings, so I attend regularly. But I had the opportunity to go back and watch or listen to the prior discussions around the exemption topic to make sure that I kind of tailored this presentation to kind of those key points that everybody was kind of chiming in on at different points. I know the particular meeting that kind of brought forth maybe the need for a presentation like this, I missed the first half of that meeting. So I did go back through, I listened, I took a whole bunch of notes to try to make sure that this was, you know, kind of geared towards kind of everybody's kind of perceptions and perspective on the matter. And so I do want to kind of start with saying that one of the things that stands out on these topics is the complexity of the different roles of the different stakeholders and then what laws then set into those complexities. So for example, right now, the ABA bill codes are not like adopted and set by, they're adopted with kind of the funder allotment of the funder being able to kind of define what those codes are. But even though the AMA has said, yes, these codes are acceptable, and CMS has said, yes, these codes can be covered, there isn't a, like, you must cover them with these definitions. So there's guidance, there's tools, there's a lot of wonderful work being done, and that has been done. But there is that caveat that right now the health plans really can define the codes how they choose. And I think that that's a really kind of important and significant role when we're talking about kind of who's playing different roles. So when you're, you know, kind of the board responsible for public protection and responsible for, you know, making sure that your licensees are you know, providing services that are in the best interest of the general public and the members that they serve, that innately has different expectations than perhaps like what a health plan would have, or what the federal law says for like EPSDT, so early periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment services for kids under 21. You know, there's a lot of kind of federal laws that fall under there. And so one of the things that I'm going to try to encourage everybody to do as we work through this is to really separate those pieces of what really conversations can be had with the stakeholders around the billing, because it would be my opinion that the billing itself would not fall under kind of this board. And so I think that while the practice may, I think it gets a little bit more complex when we start talking about should someone be allowed to bill something or not. I think that, I would caution, that piece, because there are federal laws that do kind of govern some of the practices of the health plans. And I think it's very important that as we're having these conversations, that we're not inadvertently either putting the health plans in a position to where they're having to remediate, okay, but what about this law? But also not being in a position where we are inadvertently kind of over generalizing kind of the roles of some of that public protection. I do want to say that everything that I'm going to say today is from the perspective of public protection. I am a advocate of consumer protection. As most know, I do have a child who has received services in this realm. I've worked in this field for 20 years, and I spend a lot of time in kind of that advocacy space, because at the end of the day, I think that these are important conversations for us to have. It gets sticky with the regulatory piece, right? And in researching some of this and really diving deep, I was really trying to answer, you know, kind of in my own head, some of the things that need to be done. And it kept taking me back to some of the trainings that I have with the organizations that I audit. I do a lot of auditing of organizations for quality management, accreditation prep, health plan work plans. So if an organization is kind of struggling, a health plan may ask for them to consult with somebody to kind of do an audit and help them with the work plans to kind of bring up some of those standards. And I think our field has a very significant consumer protection problem. We have, we're, you know, underserved as far as professionals available to serve, the populations that need the services. Our online programs right now are, that are training these individuals are woefully unpreparing them. I mean, they're quite frightening in some of the standards. If you aren't aware, I know some are university professors, that is going to be changing because, in order to continue to provide, the education aspect becoming credentialed, the schools are going to have to maintain a 70% pass rate, which is going to be a significant change for our field. I think it's a good one. It's going to weed out some of the programs. It's going to bring other programs up to par. When you look at the pass rates right now, they still average about 56%, which is what it was when I tested almost 16 years ago. So the need to kind of improve across the quality is there. I'm not going to bore you with my, concerns of, supervision practices, the quality of supervision and, the lack of support and oversight of first year BCBAs. But I just wanted to bring those up as kind of food for thought as we move through this is like, is this really an issue of the exemption or do we have a much larger, kind of quality control issue? And perhaps, could a solution to kind of both of these kind of feed, you know, both pieces. I do also want to just note that there are federal guidelines around access to care and also state laws for like commercial health plans as far as what their networks have to look like, you know, as far as timely appointments and wait lists and all of those things. We have a state law that clearly spells out for the commercial plans how close providers have to be in proximity to members as well as you know, what is the timeliness of the appointments that they have to have in order to provide what they would call an adequate network. And then the Medicaid plans also have the same. And so what we have learned, and there are several work groups across the nation going on this is, and this is no surprise, right? The average BCBA, I would argue the average qualified and proficient BCBA can maintain a caseload of about 12, which is drastically different than, you know, perhaps psychology, counseling, medical doctors, speech, OT, because of our higher volume that goes in the level of service. We really can't manage much more than 12 patients on our caseload at a time. Now, that is an average. It obviously should be competency-based and caseload-based. And so there are certainly BCBAs that have the skill set and are serving a population that perhaps that number could be higher. There's most definitely ones that should be lower. But the reality of it is even if we take that average of 12 and we look at the number of licensed BCBAs just here in Arizona, we aren't even able to serve a fraction of the individuals that need the services. And so when we looked at the exemptions to practice when developing the Medicaid policy, now the access to care under the Medicaid policy is very, very, very important. Medicaid has to make sure that their services are getting, or that their members are getting services. But here in Arizona, there's been two very large lawsuits. Jacob's Law, and I believe the other one is actually Jake's Law, but two very large lawsuits that have said like, hey, access, you need to figure out a way around this. And I do recognize that, that obviously, expanding the ability to practice to kind of these arms of people, comes with risks. But I also just wanted to point out that, there's some competing contingencies there, that there are, laws, that the health plans are trying to adhere to. And then I think just fundamentally, I think many of us can agree that if we have good quality training programs and we have good quality systems for delegating and oversight, that extra arm, like the BCABA, the associate level, really is appreciated from a perspective of being able to increase access to care. And, you know, for stakeholders, perhaps like the professional association or, you know, researchers, scientists, it also is important for them as well, to make sure that we're able to disseminate our science. We know how powerful it can be. We know the types of supports that we can be providing, in general. It doesn't have to necessarily be one specific population. It can be in preventative health. It can be in, jobs in the workplace, other socioeconomic, considerations, public policy, criminal justice. I mean, there's just so much that we can be doing. But if we don't have those extra arms, so much of it is limited. And so I just wanted to make sure that, that we just kind of outlined what some of those different things are, and then kind of pointed back to that North Star of that role of public protection, because I think that starts to kind of weed out, some of the other kind of, concerns, that have been presented by the, by this committee. So I want to start, I'm going to dive into a little bit of kind of the billing stuff, and I want to be clear on just a couple of things. These are billing standards that are not like behavior analysis. This exists in the medical billing world and has for a very, very long time. Again, I'll try not to go on my soapbox, but one of the challenges that I see in our field and continue to see, and I saw it early on, is that we came into the medical billing world thinking, but we're different. And so, this idea of, yeah, but it's behavior analysis, so it's different, or we have these bill codes, so it's different. That does not really hold a lot of weight when you read your funder contract. There are aspects of it that do, yes. But at the end of the day, when you're looking at that billing manual very rarely is saying, okay, and now dentists, you're going to do it exactly this way, and behavior analysts, you're going to do it this way, and psychologists, you're going to do it this way, and surgeons, you're going to do it this way. There's a lot of global language. And one of those is the concept of a rendering provider. And the rendering provider is going to be somebody who actually is delivering the services. So they're providing a clinical or a medical service to somebody. It does imply that they are directly carrying out those services. But what happens in, and we see this in the medical field as well, is that, again, there are those arms. And oftentimes in the literature, you'll see it as auxiliary staff. And so, you know, I'll use a doctor's office, for example. You may have a physician who's a medical doctor and licensed as such. You may have an MP. Nurse practitioners have licensure for independent practice. So you have a physician and a license and an MP. They can serve as what's called a rendering provider, because they are the ones who are essentially responsible for the care. But then you have like a physician's assistant or a PA. They're not necessarily independently licensed, and they do require very prescribed oversight. And they are responsible still for aspects of patient care. And so though a PA would be what you would consider an auxiliary staff member. So oftentimes what we see in billing is you've got these policies around who the rendering provider is. And then you might have a policy around, is auxiliary staff utilization allowed? And I'll kind of talk a little bit more about that in just a second. But in ABA, auxiliary staff is going to speak to two levels of supports. That's going to be three, actually. That's going to be your technician themselves. That's an auxiliary staff member. They are not independently licensed. They are not authorized to make the clinical decisions. They require oversight. Then you have the BCABA. Now, the BCABA does have additional training to be able to take on additional types of tasks. But the requirements of the rendering provider, that licensed supervisor, doesn't change. They are still responsible for the client outcomes. They are still responsible for supervising that individual. They're still responsible holistically for kind of that exercised control of the services provided. And then we have the grad students. And the grad students are oftentimes being kind of tasked with things for the purpose of expanding their repertoire. One of the things that is, and I'm going to talk to it, is the challenge is when you are using auxiliary staff, the insurance company is expecting that that auxiliary staff has already met proficiency. And I would argue that our statutes and both renditions of the ethics code say the exact same thing, that you should not be billing a brand new technician that has not demonstrated that they can implement the program for that client. You should not be billing a grad student simply because they need experience with FBAs and this is an opportunity. And I think that's where it starts to get muddied, is because we as a field have this habit of, but does the funder allow it? And that's not really what is ethical or appropriate. And so it's kind of this argument of, is it allowed and should it be done? And that's kind of the piece that has to be weighed, is even if someone says it's allowed, And I think in the meeting, it was, well, maybe we can talk to the stakeholders about, you know, perhaps some of the problems with allowing this. I'll speak to this in a moment, but I don't think that that's really the solution, simply because this is rampant through all of our auxiliary staff services. So it's not just the matriculated grad student, it's all of the services. It is not unusual to see technicians starting to bill 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks before ever actually being proficient in running a protocol. That's a problem. That's subject to recoupment by the insurance plans. That's subject to, you know, potential disciplinary action. Like, that is quite problematic. And so again, when we're looking at this, we have to think of, like, is it really wording, or is this a much, much larger issue that we have, that hopefully we can get, you know, wrapped around some training and support. So, if a rendering provider is utilizing auxiliary staff, what this is called is incident two. So when we're billing, it's incident two billing. Now, you'll see that there's oftentimes around incident two language discussion of pass-through billing. Pass-through billing primarily occurs with a lot of like physicians that are prescribing, and it happens quite often in the prescription world. And so I'm not going to go into detail about all that what that means, but some of the contracts and billing manuals will still mention pass-through billing when they're talking about incident two billing. So incident two billing occurs when that auxiliary staff is providing the scope. Again, most of the billing language will still say within their certification and their training, and they're being supervised. So again, that supervisor has to delegate, direct, and supervise the activities of that auxiliary staff in order for them to then say, yes, this can be incident two. And so, for example, a technician even providing the 97153 is still providing under a rendering licensee. And that licensee is directly responsible for delegating, directing, and supervising. Again, this is like, yes, we know this, Diana, why are you telling me? Because this doesn't change when we go to the BCABA or the matriculated grad student. That incident to billing is the same no matter what. The licensee is the ultimate responsible person. And though they can use that arm, and For those that don't know the history of ABA, the RBT is an arm because we just simply don't have enough people to serve. The intention was never like, hey, we're just going to create this really cool program and just have all these technicians and employ a ton of people, right? No, it was that in order for these services to be effective, they do have to happen at a higher volume. And in order to do that, we do need these auxiliary support. But still at the end of the day, that the health plans are looking at who is that responsible rendering provider. And I would even argue that in a state like Arizona, where we have a Title and Practice Act, that Title Act is also speaking to that rendering provider of ultimately who is responsible. And again, we're seeing a lot of issues in the industry of, well, the RBT works for the company, and the company is telling the BCBA, no, this is how it's going to be. But again, that BCBA is the one ultimately responsible. And so I won't go too much down that rabbit hole, but this is a much bigger kind of issue. Now, the pass-through billing is going to be something that might be speaking a little bit more to this committee's concerns about kind of that BCBA that is not licensed yet, or is maybe avoiding licensure for some reason or what have you. And what pass-through billing is essentially saying, hey, I'm the rendering provider, but you can use my credentials. And so you will find that when this is happening, when this is happening, it isn't just an issue with this committee, but the health plans actually take issue to this as well. Most health plans will not allow for that pass through billing that says, again, okay, well, you're a BCBA, so you can bill here. Let me talk a little bit about Blue Cross Blue Shield and kind of their billing policies. And this is in the 2024 billing manual. They have, you know, really good section that talks about, hey, pass-through billing's prohibited, don't do it. So in other words, if I were to hire a BCBA from out of state, or I were to, have a certificate, pass their exam and their pending licensure, and I just said, here, you can carry this caseload and we'll just bill it this way, that would be prohibited by the funder. And it's clearly spelled out in the funder policy. But most policies have this. I bring up Blue Cross Blue Shield simply because it's very, very clear. It's like page 19 of their billing manual. It's very, very clear. But when you go to the incident two section, it's very clear that Blue Cross Blue Shield will allow for anybody with proper training and certification and or licensure to provide an auxiliary level service, so long as that person maintains that delegation, direction, and supervision. And so in that situation, and I'm not speaking to the statute right now, just speaking to the funder policy, in that situation, then yes, it would be allowable for a certified behavior analyst to serve as an arm, an assistant, assist with portions of an assessment, maybe assist with supervision of staff, and still be able to bill it, so long as, again, that kind of that rendering provider, the licensee, the one that's credentialed, is the one that is supervising. And in the Medicaid plan, this looks about the same. It's got a modifier. Blue Cross Blue Shield doesn't use modifiers, but with the Medicaid plan, it's basically, if you're not credentialed with the Medicaid plan, which does require licensure, then you have to bill a modifier to indicate you're just that auxiliary, you're that extra arm. And what this does is this communicates then to Medicaid, hey, for this BCBA, this is how many extra arms they're using. And that's an important thing I will come back to shortly. So I think it's important that as we have some of these conversations, when we say, well, this shouldn't be allowed, or the funders can't do this or whatever, that many of these things are happening because that's the nature of even how that technician is even able to bill. And so I just wanted to give a little bit of kind of that context and what that looks like. All right. So what does that mean then? What is delegation? Well, oftentimes, it is linked to some sort of, oh, I apologize. It is linked to some sort of, relevant experience and certification. So the funders are going to say, and like Blue Cross Blue Shields does say an RBT. And so it's going to say you can do incident to billing if your staff is a registered behavior technician. Optum, you can do incident to billing if you're for 97153, if your staff is a registered behavior technician. Now, Medicaid says BHT, behavior health technician, or a registered behavior technician. So again, the funders can kind of define, hey, your auxiliary staff need to be certified or not certified, need to have this level of experience. But I would speak then to even the BACB requirements, which are that, and this is the new code. I'll reference the old one later, just to, you know, depending on which one you're thinking of. They're all of this is covered in both versions of the code. But according to the ethics code, we do have to ensure competency before delegating tasks. And that's for any level of auxiliary staff. It's not, well, you do it this way for a technician and this way for a grad student, this way for a BCBA, BCABA, or this way for a first year BCBA. It would not, if I am the one responsible for a case and I'm responsible for delegation, then I am also responsible for the competency of the auxiliary staff I am using. So let's take Blue Cross Blue Shield as an example again. So I've hired a new BCBA. They come in and they want to, you know, start to work, or I need them to start to work. Anything that it's not a simple like, okay, now I've hired them and they've been a BCBA for 6 years, 8 years, 12 years, and therefore they're good to provide these services. No, I'm directly responsible for ensuring the competency per the BACB ethics code, ensuring the competency of that person and that person's competency with the client I'm overseeing prior to allowing them to do that. So again, there are mechanisms built into that. Whether or not that's happening, that can be a different argument we can have. But again, looking at this from that broader piece. Now, I would say that our statutes say the same thing. Our statutes say that a rendering provider or a licensee, and I'm using rendering provider simply because I'm trying to navigate it back to the health plans, but that licensee must exercise control over the case and assume complete responsibility. And so again, whether it's the technician, the grad student, the BCABA, or a BCBA that is rendering services beneath me, the argument then, if you crosswalk all of this, would be, again, absent of this exemption, but would be that yes, you most definitely are responsible for delegating only where competencies have been demonstrated to you. So very similarly to delegation, we then have direction. And direction is going to be who's ultimately making those treatment decisions. And we've had this conversation at different funding levels because there's this notion out there that because someone has years of experience, then we can kind of forego this need to have clinical direction. And that's also not true. We have to continuously expand our scope, maintain our competence, and work with others to do the same. And so this, again, kind of idea of, well, you know, you are certified, so I'm going to let you, you know, kind of make these decisions is also not congruent with the funder or the ethics code or licensure. So when it comes to direction, we all know that we have, you know, an actual code for it. But this is the purpose of the direction is this is where the rendering provider is attesting to, yes, services are going exactly how I envisioned them, exactly how they should be. Okay. And that's what the funder's looking for is, are you needing to modify things? Is fidelity being met? What are these other considerations? Again, the BACB says the same thing. Like, we have to be monitoring this. And I would argue that that responsible person, rendering provider, licensed behavior analyst, is the one responsible for that. And we can delegate some aspects to it based on competency. So if someone's demonstrated to me that they can make a program change with lesser clinical direction needed than perhaps another student may need, then certainly I could calibrate my supervision based on those components. But again, this is one of those problems where there's this, again, notion of, well, you're a student now, therefore you can make these decisions. Well, you're a first year BCBA now, you can now make these decisions. And again, I would even argue you can be a 15 year BCBA. You know, I went and provided support recently to a BCBA that has been in the field 40 years. Okay. There's nothing that says that your years of experience qualify you across the board to provide all services. And so again, direction is really important if you are that licensee that services are being rendered under, because you have to be the one to calibrate who you're allowing to provide that direction and who you're not, supervise that direction. And it ultimately comes down to, is everybody safe and are outcomes being met? So again, it spoke to in the ethics code as well. And then again, back in licensure, it goes back to the same thing. We have maintenance of competence requirements. We have scope of practice requirements. We have monitoring requirements. We have evidence-based practice requirements. So this kind of larger practicing within your scope and practicing and providing services that are safe and necessary, that is spoke to in our statutes. And I have the citation there, but if anybody is curious, 32-2091-12-0, which does clearly say, hey, you are going to refrain from providing services that are unnecessary, unsafe, or do not align with published standards of care. So again, that kind of catches what the ethics code, what our current literature says, even what the bill code guidance says, and then those funder requirements, contracts, you know, those sorts of things. And so again, I would kind of argue whether it's a technician, a student, a first year BCBA, a 12 year BCBA, if you are saying, yes, I'm billing this service, or I'm the licensee, or I'm the rendering provider, you are responsible for all of this when it comes to your auxiliary staff. And then supervision. So as we are all aware, there is a distinction between clinical direction and supervision. Oftentimes, supervision is not a covered service by the health plans. They will oftentimes say, hey, supervision is something, you know, that is your responsibility to ensure that the services are being provided proficiently. And I would argue the same. A lot of people say, well, I do 97155 because we're required to do supervision. Well, can there be overlap in that when you're providing supervision, if you also have a clinical need to provide clinical direction, could you then do that? In many cases, yes, but not all. And again, it comes down to, are you supervising because it's a brand new staff member and you've never seen them implement a protocol before? Well, that's a problem because they shouldn't even be in their billing, because the ethics code and our statutes speak to, we shouldn't be delegating to them if they haven't met competency. The purpose of the 97155, again, this is a service, 97155, which is the protocol modification. The purpose of that service is to benefit the member. We wouldn't bill insurance to support a technician. That seems silly. That would be, if your dentist decided to bill additional charges because the dental hygienist was new and needed training. Like, these aren't things that happen in other practices, right? And so this, again, idea of, well, I'm going to go out and I'm going to do 97155, with this new staff member because, I want to make sure that they're running the protocol correctly is a fundamental flaw in the entire system. Now, could it be that they met they demonstrated competency in one setting and I need to go out there and ensure that it generalized. Certainly. But again, we're not getting this nitty gritty. What's happening as a field is we're kind of saying, okay, supervision, I'm going to build 97155 and not even adhering to, but wait a second, our ethics code clearly says they shouldn't even be assigned tasks if they haven't been trained to proficiency to begin with. So with supervision, the idea is that maintenance piece. So maintenance and generalization. So you've been trained on this, you've met proficiency, but drift happens or there's a new setting or a new variable. And so I may need to provide that additional support, or maybe I'm ready to start delegating, like to a grad student, I'm ready to start delegating a new task to you. While I'm delegating it, I'm still going to have to make sure that there is supervision. And the BACB speaks to this in both section 4 of the new ethics code. It's section 5 of the old ethics code. It's in both. It's very clear, again, that all of the work by an auxiliary staff member must be supervised. And you will see that most of them, and actually, it's funny because this has been such an issue. There's a lot of folks billing 97155 to supervise the graduate student. And that is not at all what that code is for. And that is quite concerning. And the argument that has been made is, well, how else do we get paid for supervising the graduate student? Well, you don't. That supervision is kind of built into, they're the arm. So either you provide the service or you build out a practitioner that you can supervise to kind of help and assist you provide the service. And again, this is where the BCABA model originated from. And so that, you know, that concept originated from. So it really isn't that it doesn't exist or that it really is that there's a lot of need for provider education and honestly, I would say enforcement of many of these things because they exist and they're clear as day. But catching them and enforcing them and even down to like, what are the health plans doing to even audit for this? I think that there's that piece is kind of what comes to mind for me because the fact that these things that we're concerned about language in an exemption, and we should be. I should preface that, but the fact that language is what we're stuck to misses this whole bigger boat of. But we have a lot of language, and we're still having these same problems. And so I don't know that just a simple language change is the solution. And again, it's happening at all levels of that auxiliary staff. And again, I do think that it's a public protection issue for this committee. Also an issue of fraud, waste, and abuse for the health plans. And so again, and I'm having these same conversations with the health plans of why aren't you guys monitoring and enforcing these policies? Because these things do exist. And if they, and in a perfect world, if all of them were, if we were educating providers, you know, efficiently, and again, they were coming in contact with the feedback afterwards, whether it's an annual audit by the health plan, whether it's recouping money, whether it's, you know, whatever it is, if they were coming into whether it's rewarding all the great things, right? Blue Cross Blue Shield now has their Gold Star program where if you send in treatment plans and you meet proficiency in the treatment planning, then they don't want you to send in the treatment plans anymore. They trust that you know what you're doing. You don't have to go through the full review. And they can definitely do post audits and change that. But there's many ways that it doesn't even have to be that the contingencies they come into contact with are punishment or potentially punishment in nature. There's many ways that we, not necessarily this regulatory board, but we as a field and the funders could set up systems to incentivize, these things. And again, that's just missing in our field, but important because I want to be very clear that all of this already exists. There is no, I don't see where the confusion is outside of not all behavior analysts are referring to this. Again, we have this overarching, well, the health plan says that this is allowed, therefore it is, without adherence to these other considerations. And then those individuals are who's training the new trainees. So we have, you know, this massive messaging issue, that is going on. And again, it's at all levels of auxiliary services. It is not just one or another. I think that's an important distinction. So just again, by way of example, an RBT transferred from another agency. They've been an RBT for 3 years. I'm going to assign them to Joe. Is that okay? Well, not necessarily, because again, the business providers making those assignments is problematic. So when the owners of the businesses, and again, I won't get on my rant of facility licensing, because I think this would be resolved if we could resolve that issue. But when an owner of a business says, well, I'm assigning this technician to you, I don't think that the average BCBA knows, hey, I now by statute and the ethics code, I now have responsibility to assume the complete responsibility of this person's performance. That's not very clear. And we've seen that, right? In this committee, there has been, well, I didn't know, or the business just, you know, did it this way and I thought it was correct, right? It is very, very important that our licensees and certificates nationwide start to really think about how all of this language is going to impact their personal careers. Because when we're allowing these types of practice, a lot of things are happening. For example, if an RBT is at another agency, they come here and I'm like, you're an RBT. That's great. Plug and play. I have no proof that this RBT had a proper background check. I had no proof that this RBT has ever worked with the types of programs that this individual child needs. I have no proof that this RBT was even supervised by the prior supervisor. And those are significant risks. Yet all day, every day, this is a common practice. People are like, yes, they're an RBT. I'm going to pay them more money and put them into this home because they don't need as much training. And I would argue that, again, that completely misses the mark on the current standard of care and the current documentation for requirements of services. So I'm not going to bore you with this whole thing, but to just put into, I don't know why it didn't show up in the white. I'll fix that before I send you guys the slides. But to put this into perspective, when I'm talking to people and saying, hey, should this RBT provide services? This is the checklist that I encourage people to go to. One, in that state, are they allowed to? And this seems kind of silly. Yes, we're in Arizona, but I don't just talk to people here in Arizona about this. So I like to make sure, check your state regulations, check your funder contract, and ensure there's incident to billing for the provider type. So one of the issues we have right now with the Medicaid plans is that the Medicaid plans do not have any writing in their billing manual now or their upcoming changes that allow for a technician to bill under the behavior analyst. Now, we're doing it and they're paying us, so seemingly it's allowed, right? But that's a problem. It should really be spelled out in the billing manual as an approved incident to billing specific to that provider type. And so some of us are advocating for that language because it's a problem even for the technician to just be able to just bill without having your funder contract specify that that's allowable. And then you've got, are the rendering providers even approved supervisors? I'm still seeing this quite frequently, that even with these behavior health technicians, which I don't know if you can see the white, but right now I'm just talking behavior health technicians. I'm not even like getting, this has an RBT in there. Let's not even say that we have the RBT piece. Like, are they even approved? Do they even know the standards for supervision? You know, so kind of working through those pieces. And then all the way down to, Do they have proficiency in the program specific to that child that they're going to be serving? And do you have a monitoring system to make sure that the services they're providing are going to be effective? So again, this is what we have to go through, not just a simple, but they're already an RBT or a BHT. Now, I know I'm going to I'm going to open a can of worms right now. And I'm doing it for really demonstrative purposes only. But I want to point out a couple of things. So we have the behavior health technician, and so I strategically separated, I'll go over RBT in a second. I strategically separated the two out because at the time that this statute was written, the RBT credential didn't exist. So when you look at 32-209108A6, what it says is a non-credentialed individual who delivers applied behavior analysis services under the extended authority and direction of a licensed behavior analyst. The individual may not claim to be a professional behavior analyst and must use a title indicating the person's non-professional status. Well, we have a little bit of a conundrum here because the way that the funders and the field and the BACB have kind of vetted this out is we now have the BTs and the RBTs. And when you look at the language for RBT, it is very much crafted as a credential and a paraprofessional status, meaning that if we want to argue that Section A3 does not cover certain people, I would argue likewise, neither does A6. There is nothing in our current exemptions that actually speak to the registered behavior technician being allowed to provide services in the state of Arizona. Now, these are not my feelings. I definitely am like, okay, Diana, this absolutely is better than just a general BHT. And why wouldn't this be allowed? This goes to demonstrate kind of that morphing across time that happens, and how legislation just hasn't quite caught up. But when we make arguments that, like, let's say A3 includes or doesn't include people, and then say, because here the statute's very clear, then I would just caution that in crosswalking some of that, we may find that that's actually an issue across multiple statutes. And this is one of them. This statute, in my opinion, again, I am not an attorney and of course we can sit here and talk about, again, the kind of semantics, but at its surface, and when you look at all of the other professional standard literature, this statute does not speak to RBTs or the BCABA, and neither one of them are actually covered in the exemptions. And so that to me is extremely problematic. So that's why I separated out the RBT checklist, is to just demonstrate that there are different state regulations for these two provider types. There are different state regulations as it sits today for a BHT versus an RBT. There are also different funder requirements. So again, you really have to break this up by those circumstances. So that's going to take me then to this concept of mid-tier. And the mid-tier billing is common in California as well. There are a couple of other states that do modified versions. I'm proud of our mid-tier billing, so I am biased to this. I will admit it. Because one of the things that is tremendously different in how the mid-tier is crafted, again, how it's being used and how it's being enforced is a different conversation. And I think, again, that's going to involve coming in contact with contingencies that shape the behavior, right? So whether that's provider education and, you know, ultimately we need the health plans to kind of be enforcing their own policies. And then if and when these come before you guys are going to kind of have this same thing, right? So then we've got this kind of conflict here. So a mid-tier, you know, people ask, so wait, a mid-tier can do more than 97153. Well, I'm going to take you to, you know, some of the other follow-up questions that tend to happen, but one of the big arguments is, well, wait a second, a mid-tier can't do those things because the AMA says that it has to be a QHP. Well, remember in the beginning when I said, really the health plans have the ability to A, define the bill code different from the AMA, and B, define a QHP. So we can't really reference that piece and say, well, this is what the bill code recommendations from the AMA are, because right now the health plans have the authority to do what they want with those codes. And so, yes, they can. And when I talk about that access to care issue, this could absolutely help the access to care issue. And if done properly, it could make better BCBAs for the longevity of you know, the field and for better public protection, right? And so I think that there's a place for this mid-tier that's very, very important. And I think it should apply to multiple codes because just like I said with everything else with the rendering provider, the statutes and the codes speak to this. So again, whether or not a supervisee is allowed to bill is going to be specific to the funder because there's nothing that there's the practice piece where the licensing board's able to say, can they practice independently or not? Or can they practice under these terms or not? Or what have you? But the billing itself actually then comes to the health plan. So, you know, we have where there's a lot of billing issues that are non-issue and or non-specific to the role of this regulatory board, right? Something like the concurrent billing of 5-3 and 5-5. Where TRICARE and other Medicaid programs don't allow the concurrent billing. And the AMA does, but again, it doesn't matter because these other plans can define it how they want. And it's not a stance that as a licensing board or a professional regulation board, you would come in and say, hey, the AMA says that this can be concurrent, so I need you guys to make this concurrent billing, or we wouldn't release any type of statutes or anything in that nature because it's outside of that scope, right? And so then it's like, okay, well, let's say the matriculated grad student is allowed to practice under extended authority, right? So they're allowed to accrue these hours, they're allowed to start getting these experiences, then does the funder have to pay for it? Well, not necessarily. So just because the licensing board says, yes, a matriculated grad student can do these services doesn't mean then that the funder has to. So when I say we've got to be careful on kind of where we articulate kind of the need, that billing piece kind of has to come out because they're very different scopes. And there could be circumstances where the board says something's allowed, but the health plans aren't willing to allow it from a billing perspective and kind of vice versa. And certainly we can have stakeholder conversations with the Medicaid plan, but then there's all the commercial plans. And then we've got kind of conflicting regulations across the bill, field. So let's say now, like in Arizona, now we have supervisees, they provide mid-tier services. Now is it that, hey, can a BCABA or BCBA provide? Well, again, it's difficult because the matriculated grad student definition in Arizona doesn't speak to either one of those. So the BCABA or the BCBA. So that gets really tricky. So I know that I was brought here for the conversation of can a non-licensed BCBA really be doing this or should they be? And again, what I'm trying to demonstrate is that same question should apply to all levels of staff. And again, that's not in absence of some of your concerns around kind of the avoiding licensure or using it as that's not an absence of that. I hear those. I understand them. I do think they're problems. But I think it's also a bigger problem because anytime I let someone bill under me as the rendering provider, regardless of what title or years of experience they have, I have the same ethical and legal requirements to exercise control over the case. So to me, that part of the argument would need to apply to all auxiliary staff level. So again, just kind of looking at there's these nuances and it gets kind of deep. So again, I've created a checklist. Again, apologize about the white, but this is just a student, matriculated grad student. Does the state regulations allow it? Cool. Does the funder allow it? Cool. Are there rendering providers? Are they approved by the supervisor? Yes. Is there, in this case, a supervision contract? Is there a supervision plan? Are they meeting the requirements of the BACB? So again, these are the things that we have to ask in order to really answer that question. It's not as simple as, does the funder allow it or not? Or does the state allow it or not? Because even if you guys say, yes, it's allowed for a matriculated grad student, if these other pieces aren't in place, if they haven't met competency in what you've delegated to them, if you don't have a system for monitoring effectiveness, and I'm not talking about overlapping with the individual. Because again, this is what we see in the field all the time is, yes, I supervised. Okay, where are your supervision notes or documentation? They're like, oh, here's the log. Did you do a fidelity check? Did you write a protocol for that supervisee? And are they following it? What are they using? What resources are being used? Did you look at the data and are you able to say that the product of this data is a direct result of the quality of services that student is providing? And again, that level of analysis isn't happening. And it's so much so that it's a common, almost always conversation that I'm having when I'm doing audits and work plans with providers, again, across the nation, not just here. And oftentimes they're arguing with me, which is fine. I love the challenge. And here's the thing. I'm not always right. But I'm pretty confident in this because it's very spelled out in the ethics code just to begin with and not even starting to look at licensure and contract pieces. Just our ethics code by itself spells this out.
Dr. Davis,
so now I go back. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm going to let Ms. Malice hop in and give a code word since you're transitioning to a new slide. I figured it would be a great opportunity. Ms. Malice, can you give us our first code word?
Yes, Madam Chair. The first code word is Labor Day. Labor Day. Thank you.
Continue.
Thank you. All right. So I'm going to go back to this statute real quick, not spend a lot of time on it. But again, we're back in this boat of non-credentialed, non-professional. So now we've got the BCABA. Where do they fit in? Because they don't fit in the exemptions, just like the RBT does not. So again, this kind of translation of the statute across time has become problematic once again. And I would encourage you guys to consider that when you get to kind of that topic of then the BCBA. So again, just a quick visual. This is what it looks like. If you're the rendering provider, you're responsible for that graduate student. You are responsible for the RBTs. You are responsible for the patients everybody is serving. This is your caseload. Okay. Your caseload is not just the patients or your caseload is not just the students. You have to, and it's, again, very clear in the statute. It's very clear in the ethics code. You have to assume complete responsibility and exercise control over the outcomes of the patients. Okay. And so when you spell this out, a lot of people say, well, then why do businesses want to use graduate students? Well, that's a great question. It does cost more. It is more work. Those that aren't doing it like this are doing it incorrectly. And yes, that is a problem. But the alternative is we have all of these students just serving in these RBT roles and doing mock assignments and then becoming BCBAs and actually having no supervised experience. And you can have in your brain, okay, once they become licensed, then we can go over assessment. Now, once they become licensed, they're ready to start their own companies and not one regulation stops them. So I do think it's really important that that we have a program that incentivizes people to use graduate students and you incentivize them by allowing them to practice a bill. And so I think that that is very important. So now let's go to that question, the kind of overarching question of then does a BCBA that is not licensed or credentialed yet, can they provide services under another rendering provider? Well, again, the argument comes down to, is it allowed by state regulations? I agree with you that if we look at the technicality of A3, it is not. But again, I would articulate, well, let me take it back. It may not be. I won't even say it is not, because I actually have information that I'll go over in a second. But when we look at then A6, are we still up against this same argument? And is this actually a bigger issue than just that simple piece of what do we do with these BCBAs that are now, you know, they just got certified in their pending licensure, or they just moved in the state. What do we do with them? And again, we're about to run into a problem. I think one of the statements was, well, they can come in and provide direct care. Well, that's not true either, because as of like January of this last year, the BACB no longer dually certifies, meaning that most funders won't allow for the BCBA to bill as an RBT. And not all funders allow for BCBAs to bill 5-3. And so they're going to have to bill 5-5, which does allow for direct services by a BCBA. But again, there's just complexities to all of that that are really muddy. And then the argument, if that's the argument, then again, we got to look at A6 and say, ooh, what else we got going on here? Now, we know that most funders generally do not allow for a brand new BCBA or a non-licensed BCBA to practice independently. However, under incident two billing, there is kind of that caveat of if they're serving as auxiliary staff, then that would be allowable. And so, again, that doesn't mean because the funder says that we can do it, the state regulations, you know, must say, or vice versa. But these are the sorts of things that we have to look at. So let's say state is clear as day, it's allowed. Funder is clear as day, it's allowed. Guess what? We still have you actually tested the competencies of this person that you were about to let bill under you? And I will tell you, most people haven't, because the billing, they don't even realize people are billing under them, because they have no idea what the billing practices of their organization is. And that's problematic, right? And then if I am the one, so then let's say that the company says, yep, you're going to be the one responsible. Now we have some people that are like, cool, you've been a BCBA 5 years, go do your thing. That's a problem. Because our ethics code says if they're billing under you, you assume responsibility for the case. You assume responsibility for the actions of that person. It doesn't matter that they've been a BCBA for 5 years. Okay. And so you have to be a part of that. You have to oversee the delegation of each task. You have to have a system for monitoring effectiveness, not just supervising. The ethics code doesn't just say, well, did you overlap with them or not? In fact, the overlaps are the least of the concerns of the ethics code. What the ethics code speaks to, and what the task list, both 5th edition and 6th edition, speak to, is that there must be a system for monitoring effectiveness. So not as simple as, did you just observe them? Did you have eyes on the case? There has to be the performance and the direct correlation with the outcomes. And again, this is already present in the ethics code. It's already present in the statute, where it clearly says that any services you delegate to someone else, you are to exercise control and assume responsibility for. So again, I kind of present that with that perspective of there's all of these components. So let's say that I start a new company. I'm working as a BCBA. I train up a graduate student. They now become a BCBA. If in like for a Medicaid, a funder would allow it, or Blue Cross Blue Shield, then theoretically, yes, this person could bill under the rendering provider. And then what would happen again is the same argument of all of these RBTs, that BCBA, and all of these patients are now the caseload of that BCBA. Okay. And again, that BCBA, that rendering provider, would still be responsible for all of that. They cannot use the excuse of, well, they were pending licensure, but I let them do it on their own. Now, could I say, here are my fidelity checks. And based on all of my data, this was something that BCBA should have been able to do, has demonstrated competency on, was doing during all of my checks, but perhaps went rogue. Yeah, that can happen. But that's not what we're seeing here. What we're seeing is a lot more of just the, well, the company just said I had to do it this way, or the company said this was allowed. And they're not assuming that responsibility. But if I can articulate that I assume that responsibility and then that person went rogue, then that's a problem. Now, if this were a model that was clear to everybody, then just like the graduate student disincentivization, right? So many people are like, why even have graduate students? Then what I think we would see here is that same disincentivization is we want them to be licensed as quick as possible because this costs the company money. It costs money to have the rendering provider having to supervise a BCBA. Okay. So again, it's about coming in contact with those contingencies, because I think all of the arguments already exist somewhere in such a way that we can navigate this. Now, certainly there are issues with the language. There's no way around it. I'm just pointing out that there's a lot more issues with the language than just this one. And in my public opinion, so my role as a member of the public, I would be generally concerned about taking a stance on one area due to a fundamental perception, as opposed to looking at multiple areas like A6. And again, I don't know that even, let's say best case scenario, statutes were wide open, we could change them tomorrow, no problem. I don't know that that's our problem. I think we've got a much bigger problem as a field, and hopefully I've demonstrated some of that. So yes, we need statute revisions. We all know this. It's not just in this area. I would propose that we look for something kind of closer to either what the psychologists already have in their statute that speaks to they have. It's not in the exemptions. It's in 3220 or 2071 subsection G that says like you can keep going in supervision. Enjoy. Keep doing supervision. You just can't, you know, keep counting the hours. So it's not indefinite. It actually says for up to 2 years. So maybe revising something like that, that says, hey, and again, there's is in qualifications for practice, and they do have a temporary licensing piece. So that's a little bit different. And I recognize that, but that's a direction. Or you can, you know, Alabama's exemptions in their statutes for behavior analysts does have in there that anybody, any trainee, and it's not whether you're a BCBA or not a BCBA, it's that if you are studying and under a supervision plan from a licensed person, then that would count as a trainee. And so again, that could, you know, maybe be the direction is to kind of broaden what a trainee definition may look like. And then I go back to this enforcement piece, because I don't know if the conversation needs to be, hey, health plans, should you or should you not be allowing this? But hey, health plans, if you are allowing this, what in the world are you doing to enforce it and make sure that it's not being misused or abused, and that you're actually submitting referrals to us? You know, there's a couple of statutes that are highly overlooked. One is in the definitions of the behavior analyst statute 32-2091, there is actually a statute that says that a healthcare facility must report any termination of a licensee to this board. I don't know the last time you guys have gotten any report about a behavior analyst being termed, with the exception of the few really egregious ones. Yet we have a statute that says, hey, healthcare facilities, if you fire this person, you need to be reporting this to us. Okay. The health plans fall, you know, under other state regulations to coordinate with other regulatory bodies. I believe you guys on the behavior analyst side, it's more pop. It does happen more often on the psychologist side, but on the behavior analyst side, you guys have had one health plan complaint. Yet we have health plans. There's a massive audit going on in access right now across providers. There's health plans that have closed their networks because the amount of fraud and abuse. Why are they not coordinating with you guys and saying, here are the providers we have concerns about? Do you know what I mean? So I feel like the issue isn't should this be allowed or should this not? I think the issue is whether it's allowed or not, are we actually applying all the other statutes to truly protect the public? So those are long-term things we can think about, stakeholder stuff, obviously things I'm passionate about and will continue to, you know, run my mouth on as a public member out to the community. But I do want to just propose that there are, I, in my opinion, there is a more immediate potential remedy. So in looking at A3, I do want to note that it does say or. A matriculated grad student or a trainee. And then, of course, it talks about an approved independent supervised field work, but then it says must be supervised consistent with the standards. So the standards set by the National Board would mean that there is a supervision plan, there's a supervision contract, there's documentation demonstrating the effectiveness of the supervision. So again, all of those things I've already talked about, I think are captured here. And then it says that that trainee has to clearly identify themselves as a trainee. And so simply because you pass your exam and now have this certificate, I'm a lifelong learner. I'm a trainee in many ways across many things. It's, do I have the authority in that setting to then identify myself as a behavior analyst? So is there guidance that can perhaps be provided of, look, just because you pass your exam doesn't mean you can hold yourself out to being a behavior analyst. So you shouldn't update your LinkedIn. You shouldn't, you know, your business shouldn't be posting a congratulations, look at our new BCBA until licensure. Because until then, you're a trainee. And you're a trainee under these conditions because they still, it's not like you can just indefinitely be a trainee and that would incentivize people to just avoid licensure. No. Being a trainee costs money. There's oversight, supervision. You know, what happens if I just, you know, I just don't want to get licensed and now I've been a trainee for 6 years and my new boss has been a BCBA for 1 year? I mean, there's no incentive to operate a business that way. And now your new boss now has to supervise you. I mean, there just isn't an incentive there. So I do think that the little caveats here, while not entirely clear, and not in negation to any points that have made thus far, I do think there's some wiggle room around, you know, if I'm just going to say it, policy statement of some sort that kind of clarifies and kind of crosswalks what language does exist to say, if you are a behavior analysis trainee and regardless of your certification or whatever, and I would argue that just because you pass your exam doesn't change your competence. It doesn't change it. It demonstrates it, but it doesn't change it. So you don't just, you know, pass your exam on Saturday and go into work on Monday and all of a sudden have a new job, right? And so I think that there's that piece of, do we just need to have that guidance of, look, you still need to have a supervision contract. You still need to have a supervision plan. And you cannot hold yourself out to being a behavior analyst. So I would propose that. Now, then people ask me, what about all the standards? I think I've made a decent point about the standards, but I have a couple of other ones to make. So obviously we know that what a defined standard supervised field work would look like. There's literature out there where there are authors, Broadhead et al. Is one of my favorite authors to quote, you know, where he talks about, look, we should have post-certification supervision programs, right? So this idea of like just taking a CEU or just talking to someone doesn't make you competent it doesn't expand your competence. So why don't we have these post-certification programs, or why don't we enroll in these? So there's literature that says like nothing stops you from enrolling in supervision again as a certificate. What if I became a certificate? My entire experience was in OBM and now I moved to Arizona and I need to practice in autism. Is it simple enough to say, hey, you're a BCBA, so therefore you should take these three CEUs and therefore you can? I don't think so. I think that would be a respecialization, and I think a supervised experience is required. So what would you do in that situation? Would you say, well, you're certified, so now you must be licensed? And you might. I mean, that I'm not saying one, but for me, and again, from a public perspective, it's like, I would rather they stay, whether long-term it's a temporary type thing, temporary type license approach, or again, it's enforcing that kind of that supervision plan piece. I'd rather they stay under supervision. And once they become independently licensed, they can't. And I know that the temporary licensure piece does give a little bit of that caveat of you now have the ability to oversee them, because if they're not an applicant and or they are not temporarily licensed, they're outside of your jurisdiction, but their supervisor is not. And I think one of the distinctions is the temporary license is important because in most psychology billing, incident to billing isn't allowed. So the temporary license does allow for them to credential for the purpose of incident to billing. For us, it is allowed, and it's allowed by the nature of the technician. And so if we were to go in and say it shouldn't be allowed, we're going to really be opening a can of worms, because now we're going to be starting to mess with whether or not a technician's allowed to bill. And so that's going to be a big problem, right? And so when we look at it from that perspective, it's like, I get the concerns, but I also am like, we do have this ability then to look at the licensee and say, these are your responsibilities. And again, I said that I would throw in both code sets. Before I send the slides, I'll go ahead and cross rock the other ones for you as well. But depending on what code set you would like to review, this is consistent with the prior code set. It's consistent with the new code set, so it doesn't really matter. But again, we've got these statutes, G, P, Q, all under 32-209112 that all say that there has to be supervision of trainees. The supervision must be within the scope of practice of the supervisor. The supervisor must exercise control and they must provide oversight. So again, you do have jurisdiction, maybe not over that individual, but definitely over the licensee, who I would argue right now in a lot of these models is not assuming that responsibility. One little mic drop piece though, that I don't think, and this goes back to why I say like, but what about the accountability with the health plans, is Access's plan does require a supervision plan for the trainee to be established for each individual client. So again, it's not the health plan saying, hey, it's a free-for-all, bill whatever. Their own standard says you must have a supervision plan in place for each client. What is supervision going to look like? How often is it going to take place? Who's going to serve in what role? For each and every client. So one, that's going to disincentivize people, right? Why do you want to do this for everybody, for BCBA, BCABA, or a grad student, right? Now I would, and obviously there are more efficient ways to do it. But it goes back to my bigger question of, if this is here and we still have these concerns, where's the enforcement? Why are the health plans not, and I speak to Access and the health plans all the time, and I'm constantly hearing, how is it that this one BCBA has 60 clients under them? Yeah, they're using students. Okay, but did you go and audit and see if they have plans for all those students and what that level of supervision looks like? Because your own policy requires it. And so again, it's that accountability piece. It's not necessarily that it doesn't exist.
Dr. Davidson.
Yes.
Dr. Byra has her hand raised.
Oh, yes, Dr. Byra.
Sorry to interrupt you before you move on, but in terms of those supervision plans, does Access have templates or examples to say, hey, if you'd like to operate in this way, here's what we'd be looking for Do we have any standards around that?
No. And here's why. And here's why I would be against such standards. We have a very bad habit as behavior analysts to want it spelled out to us by the entities that wouldn't otherwise spell it out to other like professionals. So when we look at doctors, when we look at counselors, when we look at psychologists, they're not going to the health plan and saying, can you tell me how to do this? Right. And so it gets really, really sticky when we continue to go to the health plans and say that, tell me what you're looking for. Tell me what you want. And then turn around and say, we are responsible to practice at the same level as all of these other licensed practices. So I'm generally not a big fan of that. Do I think our field has standards? Yes. So the AMPM policy clearly does reference 32-2091. So if we look back at, and I will, pushed the wrong button. If we look back at, there it goes. The statute here, I would argue that it is defined. So an approved program, and I have independent supervised field work. The statute does speak to the other two, but again, that's the messiness of the statute and the, you know, kind of growth of the field of the time. So I just shortened it shorthand here, just as a note. But it is defined here. And so when you look at the policies and you look at, okay, there is regulation, it's over the supervisor. There is a definition, 5% of supervision for contacts with your supervisor, these sorts of things. And then you have this, like, then how does this apply to the client? And the AMPM does also reference 32-2091. And so I think they all do speak to each other. And so I would argue that, yes, if you are providing sufficient supervision to meet the national standards and supervision to meet licensure. So again, this is where we as behavior analysts get really stuck. A minimum of 5%. So what does everybody provide? 5%. At least 4 contacts. And everybody's like, but that's what the BACB says. Well, no. What the BACB says is that you are responsible, and these are under the ethics codes 4 and 5, depending on which ones you're looking at. You are responsible for the outcomes and the performance. And that, again, oversight and exercised control. And so if you can get it done, here's your minimums. But if you have someone who needs more, you're required to provide them more. And you are required to articulate what they needed. Now, I once asked, and so this comes up a lot in licensure. I had asked Dr. Cindy Olvey many years ago when she was director of the board. I said, why don't we define like this post-supervision, why don't we define that in statute? And she is the one that was very much like, it is defined in statute. It clearly says you will do no harm and you will make sure that anybody operating underneath you does no harm. And while I understand as a behavior analyst, well, that's not very, you know, operational and measurable, I think this is where the AMPM says, take these two pieces and operationalize it, make it measurable under the confounds of these two pieces. And again, I think people look at one piece, so they'll look at the statute and never look at the ethics code. Or like here, they're looking at supervision and they're seeing a minimum 5%, 4 contacts, got it. But they're not looking at the ethics code that also says you have to measure performance. And you can only delegate tasks once they've demonstrated competency. So nobody's looking at these pieces. They're only looking at this piece. So again, I think that it all exists. It exactly to address the large majority of all of your guys' concerns already exists, which then takes me to the question of like, then what is the issue? What is the issue between kind of this trainer training role and licensure, and why can't non-licensed behavior analysts provide this? And I think your answer lies in the fact that regardless of the auxiliary staff level, you do have language that exists that perhaps might just need some type of, I don't know, policy statement that crosswalks what that language is so that it's clear about what the expectation is. And I mean, I will turn it over to, you know, you guys to discuss that. But I think it's worth the discussion and exploration of, would that be viable? Is that allowable? Is that something that that would fit within the confounds? Again, it is, I'm just providing the citations. I do want to just say that I do think there is a remedy to what you're currently facing. I think that, you know, we need to if we're going to have conversations with the stakeholders, I don't think it needs to be, again, around whether this is allowed or not, but rather, are you guys reporting, again, healthcare facilities, when you are terminating BCBAs, why aren't you reporting that? This is a statute issue, right? So kind of starting to have, hey, Aziaba, are you able to educate around this? Are we having these conversations with access? So again, I think it's the accountability piece is more of the direction that I foresee kind of those stakeholder conversations going. I do think that by providing a statement that links kind of the current statutes and standards, we would do a better job protecting the public. Because even when you look at that trainee piece, again, people aren't doing those things with the trainees. And then it's like now all of a sudden they're BCBAs and they're able to seek licensure and practice independently. That's a public protection concern, right? That's quite scary. And so at least by providing this guidance, you might be able to get a little bit of wraparound on a little bit of some of the quality control issues, especially since, like I said, behavior analysts like to see it all in writing very clearly. I also think that this would still offer enhanced oversight around some of these issues. Again, I still believe there's long-term solutions that need to be addressed. I would discourage a statement of, well, BCBA shouldn't be allowed to do this, because again, from my perspective, that is problematic to that other statute that then is going to kind of, for me, bode the question of, then why aren't you talking about A6? So I'll turn it over to you guys. I know that was a lot of information, went a little bit longer than I had hoped, but again, I am very passionate about this topic. So I will answer any questions, or if you guys want to just discuss it amongst yourselves, I am here.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Davis-Wilson. I think the information that you presented was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. I do know that we've got a few other items on the agenda today. So what I might propose to the committee is, if we do have questions for Dr. Davis-Wilson, perhaps we invite her back for a Q&A session. She could send out the slides. We could digest the information and come back with questions. Okay. Dr. Davy, you're muted.
Oh, I was trying to be polite. There was a weed, there was a leaf blower going on for most of the presentation outside. So sorry, Dr. Davis-Wilson. I think a little bit of time to let this sink in. Review of the slides will be important. I think a couple of things that I just noted, particularly for those that are listening in, is that, you know, Diana or Dr. Davis-Wilson makes a distinction between a healthcare institution, which has very clear rules in statute of what they must and must not do. And that does not necessarily pertain to every ABA agency out there that might be operating under their Title 32 BC designation at this point. Like, it's still some things to talk about in terms of facility licensing and around that. But I think it's important to understand that just as the MCOs have language when they start talking about ABA providers in general, that can mean a many different things. That could mean you as a sole practitioner. That could mean you as someone who works for an integrated care clinic. That could mean you as someone who works for an outpatient treatment center. And so just being aware of some of those generalities and probably coming up with a little bit of to supplement your slides, maybe we come up with some definitions. The other thing I would think, just brief reaction, is that the idea of certification and credentials, Those are defined differently. You know, what a certification is in terms of like what, you know, is it aligns to RBT status and to a BCBA is different than going through the credentialing process where someone's specific scope is ultimately approved by a healthcare organization to be able to have that engaged. And so maybe we'll have some discussion around that as well, Diana, as we kind of work to kind of clear up maybe what language we might use in an exemption if there was to be one, so that we're crystal clear as to what are we actually speaking of. Are we speaking to a certification, someone who's not certified? Is that someone who is not an RBT, not a BCBA? Are we talking about someone who's not credentialed, meaning that a healthcare organization does not recognize them as being authorized to provide said service? So there is some nuance there. Overall, appreciate the thought-provoking examples.
Are there any other comments about the presentation? Okay. Well, Dr. Davis-Wilson, thank you again so much for gracing us with this presence and your presentation. And as Dr. Davy said, you know, I think we have a lot to kind of digest and formulate and determine what actions or considerations this committee and ultimately the larger board might make in relation to the exemption that we've talked about and, you know, what it means for all of us practicing behavior analysis. Okay. Well, committee members, what I would like to propose is a 5-minute comfort break before we move into the next agenda item. Okay. We will come back. Let's just go ahead and do 8 minutes so it can be solid. Let's come back at 11:20. We are back from our comfort break, and we will go ahead and move into agenda item number 6. Agenda item number 6 is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recommendations to the board for the following complaint, which is complaint number 24-41 against Kylie Sheehan. Dr. Stenhoff is the lead on this. Before we start this complaint review, are there any disclosures or recusals that need to be made?
Madam Chair, I actually have a disclosure in regard to this. I was the owner of the company in which Ms. Sheehan is employed. I was a supervisor for the owner. However, I've not had contact with the supervisor for probably over 4 years now. So just wanted to disclose that, but I feel I can adjudicate this without prejudice.
I am going to go ahead and share some important information about our complaint review process for those who are participating today. Please note that a person or representative of a person who has filed or is subject of a complaint and is present today may make a brief statement up to 5 minutes to the committee when prompted by me. The committee may also have questions for the complainant or the respondent after their statement. Only individuals directly involved in the complaint, which are the complainant and respondent, may address the committee and make a statement. If the committee wishes to hear from any other party, it will make this request during the case review. For everyone in attendance, please ensure that your audio remains on mute. When prompted by the committee to speak, the complainant, respondents, and their legal representative may unmute themselves at that time. Please note that individuals in attendance who speak out without committee approval will be warned twice by the chair not to interrupt. If the interruption continues after the second warning, the individual will be removed from the Zoom meeting and will not be permitted to re-enter the meeting. Please only use initials for patients or children and the complainant. Be aware that the content of many records involved in these complaints is confidential and should not be discussed in a public meeting. The committee may go into executive session to discuss confidential records or to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney, Jean Galvin. At this time, I'm going to ask for the lead for this case, Dr. Stenhoff, to provide a brief overview of the complaint for the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just noting one more thing. Okay. All right. So Ms. Sheehan has been a LBA in Arizona since 2022 and is a BCBA and clinical supervisor at her place of employment, which is referred to as the agency in the documentation. The complainant AG was employed as an RBT at the agency from December of 23 to May of 24, which time she resigned effective immediately. The complainant alleged that Ms. Sheehan failed to report suspected child abuse in client one and failed to notify client two's parents related to repetitive vomiting at the agency. The licensee responded to the allegations. First, Ms. Sheehan reported that the AG did not mention these issues to HR during her exit interview, and due to her sudden resignation, was not able to have that discussion with HR either. In regard to client one, Ms. Sheehan did not have any suspicions of abuse, she also reported that to her supervisor, Madeline Rosnos, and discussed it with client one's mother. Regarding client two, Ms. Sheehan reported that she had been supervising client two services for over a year and a half. She reported that client two has a history of gag reflexes and fills his mouth too full of food. On May 3rd of 24, Ms. Sheehan reported, received a message from another RBT, the client, regarding client two, had thrown up at lunch. She followed up with, the executive director of the status of client two and was told that he was fine. Client two also did not display any other symptoms indicating an illness. Thus, it was determined that client two would remain in the site. The vomiting was also reported to client two's mother, who did not express any concerns. So at this point, this ends my summary, and I'm welcome to take any class or any questions if anybody has anything for me.
Do any committee members have questions for Dr. Stenhoff? Okay, we will go ahead and move forward. Is the complainant AG present? I'm not hearing that the complainant is present.
Madam Chair, just for reference, the complainant never responded to my email regarding the meeting, so I did not anticipate that she would be here today.
Okay. Typically at this time, we would hear a statement from the complainant. We might have questions for the complainant following their statement. So, the committee will see what information we can glean from the documentation that was provided, as well as the information that is provided by the respondent. So we will move forward with hearing from the respondent. This is the opportunity for the respondent to make a brief statement, up to 5 minutes. Ms. Sheehan, you may now unmute yourself at this time and state your full name for the record before making your statement.
My name is Kylie Sheehan. Just a quick statement. I mentioned it all in the letter that I sent as well, but client one is known to make statements that lead to him either saying he is being hurt or that somebody is hurting him. It's been a thing for a while. I've also worked with this client for 2 years at this point as an RBT and as his BCBA for a while. So I've been in home and have never witnessed any signs of anything happening in home that would be of concern for client two as well. Mom was informed of the vomiting that occurred, and since all of this has happened, he's seen, doctors and specialists. And so now they're trying to figure out some like food allergies that might have triggered some of this. So we're working through all the things. But that is all that I have for a statement.
At this time, do any committee members have questions for Ms. Sheehan?
Madam Chair.
Absolutely, Dr. Stenhoff.
Sorry, I could not find my button. They've modified Zoom. It's under stimulus control at this point. Ms. Sheehan, I'm going to just ask you probably just two, I think. direct questions. Regarding client one, you did not suspect any form of child abuse that has been put towards client one at all from the family or so on. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. And then regarding client two, you did report that to mom, and there was no evidence of any illness or that there was any issues other than what the mother has already investigated in regard to child two's vomiting behavior, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. That's it.
Are there other questions for the respondent? Okay. Shall we begin deliberations? Okay, Dr. Stenhoff, will you kick us off?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So based on the allegations that were made, Ms. Sheehan responded, I think, adequately to addressing each of the issues for each of the clients. I'm also satisfied with the questions that she answered with my questioning. And I'd actually like to make a motion that we dismiss this complaint. Or recommend it to the board that the complaint be dismissed. There we are.
Dr. Davey?
I'll second.
Okay. The motion has been made by Dr. Stenhoff to recommend a dismissal of complaint number 24-41 against Kylie Sheehan to the full board. It has been seconded by Dr. Davey. Is there any discussion before we take a vote?
Oh, just a little bit of discussion, just for, you know, I just would like to make a comment that, you know, we take the complaints are serious. Like this is, you know, comes to us from an RBT who, you know, completed the document, but then, you know, never makes contact with us again. Obviously, there was good documentation by the agency, good documentation by the licensee around these aspects. And I would just encourage all of us that work with RBTs to, when they believe that something is not quite going the way they want it to, or if there are questions around what's going on, you know, maybe a little bit above their interactions with their leaders, that we work to make sure that they're brought along in these processes. And I appreciate a read through the documentation. There was ample time for this RBT to bring this information to the BCBA as well as to the HR officials, and it was never brought forward. And so I have this, like, you know, just this, I just want to make the statement that, like, these, when someone files a complaint, it's stressful on everyone involved. And I appreciate our licensee being here and providing all that documentation. I would just encourage RBTs and BCBAs to work with their supervisors to get a better understanding of what's going on, what may be happening behind the scenes before just opening up you know, complaints at the board level. Thank you.
Dr. Byron?
Yeah, I just want to make sure, because obviously everyone on this call is not privy to all the documentation that we are able to see. So I don't want anyone walking away from this call thinking we heard child abuse and said, eh, seems fine. We did get to see all the documentation. There is protocol for incident reporting and mandated reporting outlined and retraining with HR at least yearly and things like that. So I just want, I guess, everyone listening into this case that the committee's done their due diligence to look into that. And Ms. Sheehan, I'm glad you also mentioned that parents are looking into, for client two, you know, food allergies, or if we're seeing a specialist, if there's swallow issues. So I was going to ask you about that, if we are following up in that area. So thank you for confirming that as well.
Is there any further discussion? Okay. At this time, we will take a vote. All in favor, say aye.
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 Dr. Davey, was that an aye? Okay. You're muted. Do I need to unmute?
I saw his gesture.
Okay. Sorry. Sorry, it was behind the doc or the PDF.
Okay. All opposed? Nay. The motion carries. At this point, Ms. Sheehan, what we will do is make this recommendation to the full board for dismissal. Thank you for participating today in the complaint review process. You, both the complainant and the licensee, will be notified by a board staff in writing of the date when the full board will review the committee's recommendation once that date has been determined. Okay. Let's go ahead and get another code word, Ms. Malice. Ooh, we were on the same page.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next code word is Oregon. Oregon. Thank you.
We will move over to agenda item number 7, which is likely why so many members of the public are here today to see where their application is standing. So agenda item number 7 is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recommendations to the board pertaining to the approval of behavior analyst applicants. We will go through, committee members, I'd like to follow up on some of the communication that we had since the last meeting about the way that we are processing these applications. Are we in agreement today that we would like to go committee member by committee member with the applications so that we can group together those that have no notable concerns? Okay. We'd had some communication with some of the licensee applicants. So with that being said, Dr. Davey, I'd like to start off with you.
Right.
The applicants that you are reviewing today as...
I've got a list for you.
You've got the list? Okay.
I didn't know I was going first, but I'm going to be ready here in about 2 seconds.
Okay.
There we go. There's that. And here is this. All right. So the applicants I am reviewing today are Santos, which is application 3, Rogers, application 9, Windish, application 13, and Hereta, application 15. In my review of all of those, of all 4 of those applications, including each one's education, supervised experience, examination, performance, and declarations, I find it to be both administratively and substantively correct, complete, and would like to see them move forward for licensure by the full board.
Okay. Dr. Stenhoff?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I just need to add a disclosure to one of Dr. Davies. It's application number 9, Alexis Rogers. I just wanted to disclose that I was her professor for several classes when she was attending her master's program.
Dr. Stenhoff, since you're already unmuted, let's go with your applications next.
Okay, great. Thank you. So I'm going to be reviewing 2. One needs, I've got 3, but I'm going to be reviewing one of those maybe outside of this, or Madam Chair, would you prefer me to talk about the 2 that I think are fine and then have a discussion about the other one? What's your preference?
I think that might be a good flow to go through the ones where we were moving all of these clean applications forward and then coming back to the ones that have some modifications or concerns.
Okay. Okay, great. Thank you. All right. So then I will be reviewing application number 5 and number 18. Regarding number 5, I just want to make a statement about it. So Elena Federosco, hopefully I got that close. Ms. Federosco, did have on average 133.9 hours per month, and according to the BACB and statute rule 4-26-404.2b5a, there is a limitation of that. However, because the number of hours she had and the average over those times, she's still within the bounds of having the correct number of hours. So in that case, with my review of the file, and then one more, or Dr. Byra, I note your hand up. Is that in regard to this application?
Okay. Yes, I just wanted to disclose, Madam Chair, that I did Elena Federosco's supervision a very long time ago, and I just wanted to disclose that.
All right, sorry. Thank you. And then the next application, Tricia Iona Bezgad, sorry. So both those applications, with my review of the file, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination, performance, and declarations, I find both of them to be administratively and substantively complete and recommend them to move forward to the board for approval. Madam Chair, just as a side note, my other application number 20, will need further discussion.
Okay. We will come back to your next application after we review all the clean applications. Dr. Byra, would you like to proceed with your applications next?
I reviewed 5, 4 of which can go right to the clean list. So applicant number 2, Marissa Carroll. Applicant number 4, Roxana Romano. Applicant number 8, Daniela Soares, and then applicant 22, Emily Petri. My review of the applicants, including their applicants' education, supervised experience, examination performance, and declarations, I find those all to be administratively complete. I will need to come back to Marciela Manzo for discussion number 17.
Dr. Reitz, would you review your applications next?
Yes, Madam Chair. I have 2 applicants that I can move to the clean list. That would be applicant number 11, Kaylin Richardson, and applicant number 14, Sierra Peters. My review of the file, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, and exam performance and declarations, found it to be both administratively and substantively complete. I do have 3 others that we can come back to.
Can you identify those for me just so I can keep organized here?
Applicant 1, Erin Galloway. Applicant 6, Rachel Moll. And applicant 21, thank you. Carolyn Baker.
Okay.
Thank you.
Of course. I will move forward with my applications. As we're going through these, I know we had some conversation at our last meeting, and I don't quite remember where we landed. So I'd like to consult with board staff and committee members to kind of refresh me on where we landed before I make my recommendations. We were discussing some of the grammatical errors that could be backed up by verifying documents. And if we wanted to move those forward because we had verifying documents, and just ask for a correction to be made afterwards because it's not part of that substantive review whenever it comes down to like a typo, are we moving forward in that direction?
Madam Chair, I will speak to that. I don't see a reason why you can't. I think Ms. Galvin will affirm what I say, which is, you know, if the committee can decide at this moment that slight shift can be implemented now. So if that is the consensus, and the consensus of the committee is the file is administratively and substantively complete, albeit corrections need to be, you know, registered for the license to actually be granted to the applicant, I think that's fine, and I'm getting a nod of affirmation from Ms. Galvin.
Agreed.
Okay. Let me go through here then. Would you like me to note those corrections after we talk about the clean list, like each thing that just needs a little check? That's what I'll do. Dr. Byra, I saw that you had your hand raised. Oh, okay.
It was me, Madam Chair. It's Dr. Reitz.
Oh, okay.
I have a I have a few that are minor administrative errors as well. I'll keep them when I go through, but just a note, if we do want to move in that direction, we may bump these back over to the other list.
Okay. Okay. Then, with that being said, I have...
Madam Chair, if I may. Sorry, this is delayed. I also need to know within Dr. Rates's list, I was also Kaylin Richardson's, who's application number 11, her professor, she was attending her master's program as well.
Okay. I have applicants number 10, which is Ashley Conklin. I have applicant number 12, Rafael Prieto Moreno. I have applicant number 16, Christy Egers, and applicant number 19, Brian Pena. Several of these are coming back. Ashley Conklin, Rafael, Prieto Moreno, and Brian Pena. These are coming back after that first additional information request. I see that all of the substantive requests that were made were addressed appropriately. Christy Egers, this is the first application that has come forth. I find all of these to be clean applications following my review of the file, including their education, supervised experience, examination performance, and declarations. I find them to be both administratively and substantively complete and would recommend that it moves forward to the full board for potential approval. Okay. Can we just, since this is the first time we're kind of going this route here, board staff, how would you prefer that we communicate those small adjustments that need to be made to the applications?
However you want to facilitate that, Madam Chair, probably reviewer by reviewer makes sense in my mind.
Okay. Let's go in the order that we had. Dr. Stenhoff, did you have any corrections that needed to be made to the applications that were clean?
No, I don't.
Okay. Dr. Rates, I think you went next.
Yes, Madam Chair. I have two applicants that have minor, I think, administrative errors, but certainly welcome the committee's thoughts on this as well. The first one is for applicant number one. On the spreadsheet where individuals indicate the information for supervision, there is just a discrepancy for the supervisor in terms of when they were certified. So their actual certification date based on the records that we have from the BACB is 2014, but on the spreadsheet, the date that was entered is 2019. Otherwise, that application was administratively and substantively complete. The second one with a minor administrative error was for applicant 21, I believe. This is Carolyn Baker. On the supervision, the final verification supervision form for Doreen, the form number 9 indicates that they were licensed in this state, but the state is California. So I think it is a simple no, not yes.
Correct me if I'm wrong here. I had applicant number 21 circled as one that we needed to come back to. Was she on the clean list earlier?
No, neither of the two I gave you were because of those little administrative errors. Does that make sense?
Yes. Do we want to add them to the clean list? Is that the way we're proceeding with this? That since they're not substantive issues and instead they're administrative errors, that we're moving them forward with requests?
Mm-hmm. I think so, yes.
Okay. All right, so I'm going to move off. You said applicant number 21 is on your clean list, as well as applicant. What was the other
number
one?
Number one.
Okay.
With just those two adjustments.
Okay. Great. Dr. Davey, did you have any administrative corrections that needed to be made to any of the applications that were on your clean list?
Yes, thank you. Just one to be noted, and that would be for applicant Santos, or sorry, Alexis Rogers. The portion that is filled out on the online version with regard to her supervisors and the end date of supervision, it appears that she has just flipped some of the dates for Dr. Bonet and her other supervisor. Again, both looking at the verifying documents, everything was fine, but just has like the supervising end date for Haley Toner is December 16th, 2025, for example. And so just minor dates that need to be adjusted does not change anything. Thank you.
Excuse me, Dr. Byra, did you have any adjustments that need to be made on your clean list?
I don't think so. One of the applicants, there was an issue with their supervision form and then it got resubmitted and the new submitted one looks great. So I'm assuming if it's been submitted to the board staff that their file's up to date. So I'm thinking no.
Thanks. I will now move forward with some of the things from my list. Applicant Caitlin Burford. Her supervised work experience or independent field work verification form that was completed by Amy Heath states that the dates of supervision ended on November 1st of 2028. All the other documentation in the file shows November 1st of 2018. So with that being said, I think that small error could be corrected. Again, not substantively concerning. Rafael Prieto Moreno supplied all of the necessary documentation, and then the supervisor that supplied the verification form shows that she's licensed in California, and she's not licensed in California. That was the supervisor, I want to say. It was Luis Morales, I want to say. I'd have to go back and take a look. One of them says that they are licensed. Nope, it was Rebecca Pulowski. That's what it was. So there was that submitted form that says licensed in California. Ashley Conklin's, whenever we look at hers. I believe she corrected all of the pieces whenever she came back with the fair. And Christy Eagers. Christy Eagers, her graduation date is listed as May 6th of 2027. I believe this to be 2017 on all of the other documentation. And her supervision dates, they range from March 1st of 2015 until July 31st of 2026. I believe that was 2016. So these are just, I think the two was entered instead of the one in the place of 26 and 27. The verifying documents support 2017. So correcting that. And Brian Pena, he has a supervisor that also says she's licensed in California. So those are all of my corrections. But again, I would list them on the clean list, all of the supervised experience and their application, their examination performance, declarations. Those are all not any concern to not be able to move them forward to the full board. Okay. With all of those clean applications being listed there, let's go ahead and move into the applications that need some discussion. Let's start with application number 6, Rachel Mole, Dr. Rates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I noted for this application is that the supervision forms that were provided, if you're looking at the file, it starts on page 33. They are not the final verification form for either the BACB or the one that we provide for the state. They are the experience verification forms where everything has been included, but not our final one where the supervisor needs to check off each of those boxes. So I believe if my committee members agree, we need to go back to this applicant and ask them to complete the final verification form for their supervision hours.
I'm actually wondering this because at the time that this was submitted to the BACB, I was submitting documents to the BACB, and I'm actually wondering if there's a way to confirm that this was the final experience verification form in 2014.
Perhaps.
I don't know how we would is it something that we could get in historical documents from the BACB? I'm just going to look through my files for a second, my paper files. I'm pretty confident in this. Give me just a second.
I love that you have them right there at the tip of your fingers, Madam Chair.
And they're all paper. So just hope my house doesn't burn down. It has expired, the 7-year statute, but I can't get rid of them. I just can't.
Madam Chair, if you need to borrow a scanner, I would like to offer ours for in service to you.
You have a scanner, but I also... I don't know. I like paper. I happen to have the exact same verification form that I sent to the BACB. It is the exact one. If you'd like to see them, they look exactly the same. It's kind of blurry. I feel like I can confidently confirm that in 2014, this was the final experience verification form that was accepted by the BACB.
In that case, then...
Is this an okay way to confirm this? Okay, great.
Then I will amend my initial grouping and... Please include this applicant in the clean application process. Everything else with the application met our standards. Thank you, Madam Chair.
It's just a coincidence. That was wonderful. Okay, let's move to applicant number 17, Dr. Byra. This is Maricela Monzon.
Great. So this applicant was living in Arizona, but was doing schoolwork through FIT. For 889 of her hours, she was overseen by a licensed BCBA here in Arizona, but 837 of them are from Amy Inman, who is not licensed in the state of Arizona. So that's, I don't know if she's on the call today, but there is also some kind of difficult to discern information in her correspondence with Ms. Malice, because there was also someone listed on one of her supervision forms where there was, you know, multiple supervisors. There was a Caitlin Whittings, who is an LBA in Arizona, but it doesn't indicate how many hours that she supervised. She was just listed on the multiple supervisor site verification form. And there's an email between Ms. Malice and our applicant that Ms. Einman was doing her first hours because she was still in school, and those hours were overseen by Tammy Jurics, who was the licensed behavior analyst. But like I said, the two different forms, half of them are assigned to Ms. Einman and the other half are assigned to Ms. Jurzik, who is the LBA. So I'm not really confident as to what went on here. So I'll look to my committee members, but I think we need to issue a FAIR to get some better information here.
I would agree with you, Dr. Byron. I think a FAIR is in order.
Okay. Do I need to make a motion?
Yes, please. And in doing so, excuse me, Madam Chair, if you could, you know, articulate exactly, you know, what you want, as though you were articulating bullet points, for staff's benefit. And then, what I heard or inferred, I think too, was that, the applicant's presence would probably be very helpful. So, I don't see her to be here today. So the FAIR can include a request that she come to the next, or the committee meeting at which her application will be revisited. So you can get the clarity that, it sounds like you need.
Okay. There's a couple items. So one, if we can get, I'd like to make a motion to issue a FAIR containing the following. I'd like to see how many hours, if any, were overseen by Caitlin Wittigs. Sorry, guys, me and phonics aren't friends, as she is listed as a licensed behavior analyst in Arizona. If there are additional hours that the applicant has received post-certification, that would potentially count. I also have a concern that she lists in the email that she was doing an intensive practicum and she said, quote, some hours were earned through my classes. So I also want to make sure that we are not counting coursework towards our supervision hours. Again, it may be just the way the email is written, but I'd like to get some confirmation surrounding what hours were counted and how they were counted by those supervising her. Is that clear, Madam Chair and board staff? Sorry, that was a mouthful.
I believe that to be clear, board staff. Okay. Let's move to application number.
Does that need to be seconded, Madam Chair?
Sorry. Oh, it sure does. I was just ready to keep going. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay.
Second.
The motion has been made by Dr. Byra to issue a FAIR to applicant number 17, Maricela Monzone, with the information that was just listed. It has been seconded by Dr. Stenhoff. Is there any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
All opposed, nay. The motion carries. Now we will move to applicant number 20, which is Cheyenne, I believe that's it, Carlson, Dr. Stenhoff.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So a FAIR requested a few things. One is a verification of Victoria Frescura's BA license in Texas, verification of Monica Reveille's BA licensure in Texas at the time of supervision, and or a public records request that may need to happen to get those verifications. Ms. Carlson actually did, we did receive Monica Reveille's license verification for Texas. However, we do not have Victoria Frescura's evidence of licensure. There was a document that was provided on pages 4 and 5 that it looks like a license search or a license info, but there's not an exact heading on it. But it does indicate that there was a license expiration of August of 2022. For Ms. Bescura. And so, I guess I wanted to have a conversation about whether this document would be acceptable indicating that. So it It looks, it looks very, there's no headings on it. Does it looks semi-official, but maybe not. So
Am I able to comment on that? I did request directly through their online portal system, and I did ask on multiple times for the similar documentation as what they provided for Monica, and they kept sending me the same one. And I'm not sure if it's because the license was transferred to Washington, and she had to go through that process, but I tried really hard to get the same documentation,
Yeah, I
and
know.
they kept sending me this one. So I apologize for
Yeah.
that.
No, there's no apology necessary. Thank you, Ms. Carlson, and thanks for the attempt. So, we'll take a look at this. There's been multiple attempts made by the applicant, and looking through this documentation here, I'd be inclined to accept it, but I don't also don't want to set precedent for this too. But again, it's on pages 4 and 5 of the application or of the PDF. And then maybe Ms. Galvin, I don't know if you can chime in on this. I guess the implications of accepting this is evidence.
Are you looking for other solutions to obtain documentation that might be more acceptable, or whether this file you believe provides sufficient evidence that you are in need of?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean both. I see Ms. Pakkinen has her hand up too, but
Happening?
yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm scrutinizing the document very closely, and just to confirm, Dr. Stenhoff, it begins on page 4, correct? And then there's a
Yes, it starts on 4, and then you see then the license expiration is noted on page 5 of that.
Okay. One question I would have that would help, I guess, affirm the, the legitimacy of the source of the document, and I'll direct this to the applicant. How, by what mechanism was this received? Did someone from, the state of Texas, email this to you, and you could supply an email that reflects that, that's how it was transmitted? I am not certain.
No, ma'am. They actually have a portal through the Texas government where I request it directly through the portal, and then they upload the PDF into that portal, and then I download it and send it to you guys. And I do have history of that communication within that portal, but it would be a screenshot of the actual website.
Okay, thank
And all
you.
requests have to go through that portal. I did try to get someone on the phone to see if they could directly send it to you guys, but they asked that all of the communication go through that portal.
So what I can say, what I observe is that this report would be the terminology that's used, sort of the actions that were captured and reflected, in the system would be consistent with, what you would expect from a primary source, a state board, that, licenses, professionals. So, I mean, from a, does this look, legitimate, from that, an administrative regulator perspective? That is what I see. I'm not sure I'm seeing anything else that, you might be looking for, but take that for what this is worth, that this content to me seems like it would be something that a state board, portal would reflect. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Ms. Galvin, you know, as far as the legal implications, is there anything that would cause future problems with this committee or the board if this documentation was accepted?
No, because each case is evaluated on its own merits. This document is unique to this application. And if you found that, you know, you believe that it's sufficient, then that would be okay to accept and approve. Every application is reviewed on its own.
Okay, thank you.
And Madam Chair, one more observation. The redactions of the content too would be entirely consistent with what we would redact. So that again is another reflection of this appears to be, you know, this is consistent with the type of documentation that one would reasonably expect a licensing authority to issue.
Well, Madam Chair, based on the conversations with Ms. Galvin and Ms. Pakanan, I would I recommend that this application move forward to the board for approval. Thank you, Ms. Pakanan and Ms. Galvin, for the statements you made. Appreciate it. It was very helpful.
I believe that is every application that was on the agenda today. Can committee members confirm, because I went in a little bit of a different mechanism or order this time. Did I miss anyone? Okay. Now we need to make a motion for the applications, correct? Okay. And we made our recommendations. We only had one fair, and we already made the motion for that. So the rest of them are all clean applications. Okay. Is there a motion to move forward the clean applications to the full board?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Okay, the motion has been made by Dr. Stenhoff to move forward the applications identified on the clean list. It has been seconded by Dr. Reitz. Is there any discussion? Okay, we will now take a vote. All in favor, say aye.
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 Okay. All opposed, nay. The motion carries. Okay. I'll just kind of survey the committee here. Does anyone need a quick comfort break before we move forward to the next section of the agenda?
Madam Chair, I'll just let you know that I need to step away around 12:30 just to deal with a quick phone call for my day job.
Why don't we take a comfort break at 12:30?
I've been pushing it off till I told them I could give them 15 minutes to help them problem solve this issue, but I will get back on as soon as I'm done with the call.
Okay. We'll look at our comfort break around 12:30 then. Okay, and just to confirm, we had no applications for licensure via universal recognition, and we had no requests for telehealth registration. So we will move to agenda item number 8, which is discussion, consideration, and possible action concerning draft proposed revisions to Arizona Administrative Code R4-26-406. Ms. Pakkinen, could you provide an overview of this agenda item for the committee?
Yes, Madam Chair. During the board's most recent meeting on August 2nd, the board did approve the recommendation forwarded by this committee to revise the rule R426-406 to incorporate by reference the most current version of the BACB's Professional and Ethical Code for Behavior Analysts. Oh, I see a typo. It's the 2022 version. In doing so, the board acknowledged that the rule language may need to reflect that this version was also updated in 2024. So, from that point, then that sets the wheels in motion in terms of me seeking approval from the governor's office to move forward with the rulemaking, which was swiftly approved. And so within a day or so, I was also able to meet with our contract rule writer, Jeannie Han. For those of you who haven't had any sort of experience in working, you know, with her or understanding her role, with this board. She has decades of rule writing experience and, prior to her retirement, she was the, director of the Governor's Regulatory Review Council. So she brings a set of knowledge and skills and experience that no one else possesses. And so we're very fortunate that she is willing to collaborate with us. So once I explained, you know, the issues around, you know, the challenges, if you will, or the intricacies, we'll call them, to properly incorporate by reference the version of the code that I know the committee and the board wants to achieve. What she then drafted and presented is what you see in that appended to the memorandum. So it's quite simple. It's quite straightforward. On the very last page, page 6. So Jeannie has framed this that we are incorporating. Oh no, it is the 2020 version. Okay, the 2020 version updated February 2024. Is that correct? I need to stop here. Now I'm confusing myself if it's 2020 or 2022. At any rate, what she's recognizing is, or drafting it so that the language recognizes the current edition, and, in the process recognizes there was an update more recently. And with that, I'll take questions and, ask to make sure that I am landing on the wrong or the correct date for this language.
Muted. Ms. Packinen, I can confirm that it is the 2020 version that was updated in February of 2024.
Thank you. I somehow managed to conflate those dates, and I wasn't willing, my brain wasn't willing to commit to any particular one as being, you know, correct. So I think where we are is that this is the language that will be acceptable and meet the standard for the rule writing, rule language requirements that we have to meet. So the date, of course, was the deficiency that our current rule represents. So Ms. Han is confident that if we represent the incorporation by reference in this way, then we meet what is required of us as a rulemaking agency. That notwithstanding that the BACB will, of course, it's widely acknowledged, there will be another version. There will be perhaps other updates, and we can't control for that. We can only adjust for that as, you know, through the rule promulgation process.
Dr. Davey?
Yeah, just in the language, Ms. Packinen, maybe it is, they were published in 2020, that is correct date, went into effect per the BACB in 2022, and then most recent updates were pushed through in 2024.
Okay. Thank you for that, Dr. Davey. So the 2020 edition, because the document has the copyright or the published date is 2020, that is how the rule is required, or the incorporation by reference must be framed so that any reader of this rule could navigate to that document and see, okay, you know, it has the 2020 date stamp on it, even though it was in effect at a later date.
Yeah, and that's how the BACB footnotes that the document should be referenced as the 2020, and that is when it's copyrighted.
Right.
Yeah, very good.
And if I may, you're going to see some more discussion around this issue next month when I do the BACB update. So it's uncanny in a sense that some jurisdictions have really wanted to have some conversation around the BAC's, you know, practice and customs around, you know, how they update, how they publish, how they, you know, the frequency, the schedule, and so forth with respect to the code of ethics. So suddenly there's a spotlight on this issue, and I don't think it's because of us necessarily, but there'll be more information coming your way.
Do any committee members have questions or comments related to this agenda item? Okay.
So, Madam Chair, this will go to the board for the board's approval. And then once we have the board's approval, assumedly that will happen on September 6th, then we will move forward with the filing the docket opening, you know, notice of proposed rulemaking. At some point in time, I would anticipate asking this committee if you want to help staff a public hearing so members of the public can register comments. We can do that, I think, virtually. If not, we'll arrange an in-person opportunity. Of course, any stakeholder, any member of the public can submit comments in writing as well. So the timeline will unfold based on, you know, the time it takes to move from milestone to milestone. So we're still very much at the early stage of this process.
Thank you, Ms. Pakkinen. Given our time frame until 12:30, what I'm thinking we should move into is agenda item number 10, and then we'll come back to agenda item number 9. Agenda item number 10 is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recent updates from the Behavior Analyst Certification Board. Ms. Pakkinen, this is also you.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. No update at this time, but what I just described to you in terms of, you know, some conversations happening in the regulatory realm on the regulatory regulators listserv, there are two conversations that I'll be bringing to you next month. So one is specific to you know, how boards are how their language, statute or rule language recognizes or cites to the BACB ethical code. And there will be another conversation as well around temporary licensure or temporary permits. So, you know, both topics of keen interest to this committee. So I will bring that material to you next month.
Okay. Maybe we'll do agenda item number 11 next as well. I just anticipate agenda item number 9 will take a little bit of time to discuss, and we may want to have all parties present for that. So maybe we look at agenda item number 11 and then take a quick break until Dr. Davey can return back. So agenda item number 11 is new agenda items for future meetings. Do committee members have agenda items for future meetings? Dr. Byron?
Can we add an agenda item to invite back Dr. Davis-Wilson for Q&A?
Other agenda items for the future? Where are, I'm trying to recall, did we finalize our discussion of licensure in for behavior analysts in schools? Or do we need to circle back around to that as far as how we bring behavior analysts who are practicing in the school system into compliance with licensure requirements?
Madam Chair, I can speak to that. At this time, a proposal has been prepared that reflects, you know, what the committee had, you know, certain parameters in terms of, you know, we want to communicate to the BCBA world in Arizona, you know, what it is that we have identified relative to a path to compliance and so forth. So that task was delegated to Dr. Stenhoff and me to bring the proposal to the board. So the board will see that next week on their September 6th agenda. So I'll be able to bring, you know, the board's decision back to this committee. The way the proposal reads is that this too is a, will require some time, considerable time, you know, for stakeholder input. You know, possibly we will see the messaging evolve or change as stakeholders give input into it. So it's going to come back to the committee. It's going to come back to the board. So, you know, especially because of the stakeholder involvement. So it's not over, but it's at the stage where it needs to be placed in the board's hands, you know, for the board to really confirm and set the course.
Okay.
Thank you for that, Ms. Benjamin. I wasn't quite sure where we were.
And Madam Chair, I do not want to delay the entire committee. And so please don't, you can have the conversation. Okay. I've put the documents on the very cool graphics that I don't know who was in charge of, Heidi or Paige, but please don't delay. I can always listen to the recording. And if I have anything to add, I can always reach out to board staff directly.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Davey. I also
I'll just say, Madam Chair, quickly, all the credit to Heidi. I'd love to say that I took those graphics and made them so lovely, but I did not.
I don't know if we need to add an additional agenda item for it, or if I could just throw it out there now. We do have AZIABA coming up, and it might be important to note if we have a quorum present at the conference. I'll be in attendance. I believe Dr. Byra will be in attendance. Dr. Rates, will you be in attendance? We have a quorum, so do we need to issue a public statement?
Madam Chair, so just as a matter of routine, sometimes I know there to be attendees or assume there to be, sometimes I know there will be a quorum, but at any rate, just out of an abundance of precaution, I will put what's called a courtesy notice on our website. And basically the notice puts the public on notice that, you know, you may observe that members of, you know, whatever public body are in the same place at the same time, but they are not conducting an official meeting. No business will be done. We trust they're behaving themselves, you know, and all those kinds of things. So the public is assured that you're not taking advantage of this, you know, time and opportunity to have clandestine, you know, meetings. So the courtesy notice will go up, and that is, traditionally the way it's been handled, and it conforms with the state of Arizona's open meeting law.
Perfect. Okay. Well, let's move to the second to last agenda item, which is agenda item number 9, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding exploring potential application timeframe improvement strategies. Ms. Pakkinen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So by way of reminder, Dr. Rates volunteered graciously to meet with Ms. Malice and me for purposes of really our assignment that we took away from the discussion, and it was recommended by me that we try to, use a comprehensive checklist to categorize what actions and what responsibilities are assigned to specific application errors. And so Ms. Malice had brainstormed, what was a pretty extensive list of errors. I know you've seen it. And so our intention was to work from that list, and also in the process, by assigned responsibility, I mean, this needs to be resolved during the administrative timeframe. This other, type of error needs to be resolved during the substantive review timeframe. But when we assembled, what we quickly realized was it's not that simple. It just can't be that simple, because you know, Ms. Malice very insightfully explained that, you know, there's so many variations on the same theme. So we may, you know, sort of approach an error, you know, in a particular way, but there's always an opportunity for that error to look different, you know, in reality. And so once we realize the sheer futility of trying to do this, you know, come up with, you know, an exhaustive, comprehensive, catalog, if you will, of errors, we decided to go rogue and do something entirely different. And it's something that it's kind of, it's a little difficult to articulate in a memo. So what we decided was that, we would jointly explain, you know, what it is that we are proposing and, you know, and the merits of what we think this proposal constitutes. So, what has been the longstanding practice, of course, is that when an application is submitted and supporting documentation, you know, is sourced from and arrives, you know, at, into our office at different times. So there's a very comprehensive review that falls to primarily one person. And that's the licensing specialist. And so, you know, the licensing specialist has, held the responsibility, a very high level of responsibility, for discerning, you know, what is acceptable and what isn't. Of course, you know, relying to a significant degree on, you know, what the precedent is and what the committee has articulated, you know, that this is a deficiency, this is an error, and so forth. Well, what that does, of course, by putting one person in charge of 160 applications with an extremely high error rate. The error rate mostly the result of applicant represents one set of information and facts. The verifying document represents something different. So the reconciliation process of those things, that's why, that is much of the reason why, you know, the backlog is so big, and the timeline for applications in the administrative time frame are so very long. So what we are suggesting is that when an application is received and then the verification documentation arrives, undoubtedly Ms. Malice is going to see discrepancies. What she will do is succinctly and simply capture those as bullet points, just to, if only to give the lead reviewer and all members of the committee a heads up, hey, I find this to be an issue, but she is not responsible for correcting it. She is not responsible for engaging, you know, in a protracted exchange of emails with applicants, with supervisors, and so forth, to try to arrive at, you know, the an error-free representation of the application. So the application goes to the committee then with known issues, right? They are documented and observed. That, of course, helps the committee members, that signals, even though I'm going to do my usual thorough substantive review, it's helpful that Ms. Malice has singled out, you know, these two concerns. I will, of course, pay attention to those. So in this process, we will accelerate how quickly applications come then to this committee. So we're going to define administratively complete as all application fields are completed, which of course they would be. The applicant couldn't submit if they weren't. The documents associated with that application, they have all been received. Just by meeting that standard alone, that's enough for the application to move forward. Errors included. And so what's important about that too, and significant, is that that accelerates Ms. Malice's ability to upload even flawed documentation, error-riddled documentation, to the applicant's portal. And so the applicant, if they're paying attention, and we hope they are, they can see for themselves, I represented my supervised experience in 2019 with this information. My supervisor, former supervisor, represented it differently. It's incumbent upon me. I have to demonstrate I'm qualified. I see the discrepancy. So I see an opportunity also proactively to communicate what is correct during the administrative time frame. So applicants will be able to see, you know, a more complete picture of their file much, much faster. We will also urge, we're going to change our position, so that we urge applicants to come to the committee meeting. As you have so frequently articulated, we're grateful you're here, to the applicant, because you were able to clarify and assure us of what is factually correct. You were also able to hear of what we need and require of you for your application to go forward. We understand this may precipitate an increase in FAIR letters. We get that. We also understand that we are giving applicants or verifiers, supervisors, a very small window of time from CBA meeting to board meeting to correct the error. Some may be able to turn it around quickly, some may not, but we're shifting that responsibility and the burden away from Zakiya. We're putting it back on the applicant and the verifier. And, you know, they may have only 72 hours to correct it for the application to be on the board agenda a week later. But we really need to relieve that burden. And I think applicants shouldn't find anything wrong with this process, right? They are asking us, demanding of us, as are their employers, when is this going to the committee? When is this going to review? We now have a plan and a solution to, we're convinced, to get that application on that track much faster. But in doing so, the responsibility and the consequences for what the application does or doesn't represent, that's now on you, the applicant. And I'll stop there because I'm sure you have questions and comments about this modified proposed process.
Dr. Byra?
I mean, overall, I love it. Just a tech question. Is every field right now set to required? Because I know when we get the applications, I do see things still labeled as unset, and I'm just not sure if that's because it's not applicable to that application or it was skipped. I just wanted to confirm that if it's listed as unset, it was just a question that wasn't presented.
Yes, Madam Chair, Dr. Byra, what you're seeing is really some settings that you'll soon not see those anymore. They are irrelevant, superfluous, you know, to the substance of the application. When we shift to the new summary view, you're not going to see some of this, you know, behind the scenes, those tech settings that really are not germane at all to the application. So they won't distract you anymore. The new summary view will be just represent what you need to know to ascertain is this application qualifying. So that's coming.
Awesome.
Good question.
Dr. Rates?
Chair, just one more point in our discussion that I think is important for better or for worse. We identified anecdotally that when some of these things are brought up in the meeting and we do have the applicant here, the response is much faster in getting that resolve versus kind of this back and forth email exchange that happens prior to the committee ever having the application in front of them. And so again, we think that this will help to speed things up and also hopefully show applicants that if they can turn this around speedily, they can respond quickly, we can move them forward. And, you know,
for everyone, this will be helpful to have more licensed behavior analysts in our state.
Madam Chair, the excellent point by Dr. Rates. And, you know, I'm really pleased that we pivoted the way that we did. It was, I think, immediately obvious to all of us that, this was, even though we were given an assignment and we did it very differently, this is, really the most fruitful way to move forward. And, you know, just to sort of highlight what the scenarios, what I attempted to illustrate here at any rate would be on the first page, that, you know, we could save as much as what's 135 minus 107. Is that 22 days? You know, we could really shave a substantial amount of time. We think these are realistic scenarios, that we could really reduce the time, you know, for an application to get from submission to approval. You know, it's not, it'll never be 30 days. And, you know, we still have applicants and employers who, for whatever reason, you know, in their minds, that is the expectation, that that is what they believe the standard is or should be, that, you know, 30 days after we receive an application, it should be going to the board. You know, we will never represent that that's feasible. But, you know, this to me represents, I think, a realistic and reasonable improvement in the administrative timeframe. The substantive review timeframe is swift. It's committee to board. The time clock stops if the committee issues a fair, but that's 7 days, plus, you know, the time of the notice that, the timing of the notice that Ms. Malice issues. So that's why our substantive review, timeframes, we rock those. And so the goal is really, you know, to make the improvements in the administrative review timeframe. So, and then on the second page, I think what we were looking at here was, I represented this wrong. So scenario, the top scenarios are the current, on page one are the current procedures, and then the proposed procedures are on page two. So you can see there, you know, again, we're achieving, we're completing these in a shorter time frame. We're compressing that time frame. And again, we really think that, you know, we can go from 100 days to 75 days and maybe even improve, you know, as we keep finding, you know, that this is working, we may be able to reduce the administrative time frame even further. So
I do think it's noteworthy that this is the last agenda item that we are on today. It's 12:42. So we're doing things, you know, even if they're small things, to shave time off, because if we are booking, you know, until 2:30, you know, perhaps we can get more applications on there until we catch up.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. I also, you know, I don't see a representative from AZABA still on the call. I could be missing someone, but, you know, I personally would like to thank AZABA for the efforts that they are doing to support the board. there was a recent, it went out 2 days ago, a licensure delay update. They are describing to members of AZABA what is the challenge that that board staff are facing with the exponential increase in license applications. And AZABA said that they had their lobbyist meet with key individuals from the governor's office to discuss resource allocation for the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners. And while that might be a long-term solution, you know, way, way in the future, you know, it is something that I'm personally thankful to AZABA for the support that they are providing to assist in the licensure delay resolution process.
And yes, Madam Chair, I think I can speak to this, and I'm not going too far too far away from the agenda item, but yes, AZABA, my communications with their group have been nothing but positive. And, you know, I can't articulate emphatically enough how appreciative I am. But we did turn in the budget submission appropriation requests for fiscal year 26, which means it's for the year beginning July 1, 2025. So that's starts, you know, that's 10 months from now. But we are in the proposal, we are requesting to expand our staffing capacity for licensing by 20%. So I really, really hope that, and I suspect, you know, the timing on the part of AZABA was quite deliberate. So as our budget submission was turned in on the 22nd, I believe. And so, you know, these conversations are happening where, you know, a key stakeholder group, a group that represents, you know, I don't even know, hundreds, upwards of stakeholders, you know, this is a big issue. So those conversations are happening at, you know, really the ideal time. So I chime in with my appreciation. Just for what it's worth, I am, bear with me, I meant to have this queued up and I was a little delayed, but I'm pulling up the aging report. Well, I won't be able to give you a decent number right now, but I wanted to see just sort of where we are, were with our, how many applications we have open. The tricky part is that, you know, undoubtedly some of these applications have been abandoned, where, you know, the behavior analyst, the applicant changed their mind or, you know, something else compelled them to do something differently. But, I could easily see 175 or so applications are still active, could still be active. We know that there's probably some that aren't, but 175 have the, it, plus or minus, have the potential to still be, you know, active that, that Ms. Malice needs to track and work and process. So, you know, one part-time person for 175 applications. To me, that's very, that is beyond daunting.
Do you know how many new applications came in this last month?
I can run that report if you, want to have some related conversation on this agenda item while I pull up the report.
It's okay. I can get it later. I'm just wondering how many of them, you know, are those that have been waiting and waiting to be reviewed and how many of them are fresh so we can kind of anticipate when we will be able to clear the backlog or if, you know, we'll catch up, you know, as we're making these improvements in the process. I'm just trying to think of, you know, new people that are coming through. Ms. Malice.
Yes, Madam Chair, we have approximately about 32 applications that have come in the month of August.
And Madam Chair, that is that's consistent with, I need to pull up the graph that I haven't updated for a couple of months, but I know I presented it to this committee where there was a period of time month by month where, you know, you were seeing that fluctuation in applications. I think in December, we dipped down to around 20 and then, which, you know, there's probably some assumptions to be made there. And then, you know, as we moved into the early months of 2024, that level reached, you know, back up to 30, above 30. And so it doesn't shock me that Ms. Malice, just shared the number that she did with you. That's pretty much the reality that we're living in.
There any more discussion on this agenda item?
So give us a little bit of time. If the consensus of the committee, I don't know if you need a formal vote or if it's, you know, merely a consensus, but if you want to make the shift, you know, we still want to make sure that I've really been reticent to create a situation where we just say, okay, we know this application is riddled with errors. Here you go, committee, and good luck with this. You know, we want to still be helpful. And so that's why I think, you know, an attempt on our part to catalog what we know to be issues with the application. If that is all we are doing for the benefit of the committee, and that's acceptable, great. You know, but maybe we try this for a while, and over time, you know, we sort of arrive at a set of procedures that, you know, that adheres to the spirit of what we're trying to do, but also, you know, doesn't leave you as reviewers with, you know, hours of additional time that you need to spend on applications. You know, Dr. Rates was assuring during our conversation that, you know, the substantive review, you know, you're doing what you're going to continue to do what you're already doing. So, you know, maybe just this effort to highlight or call to attention, you know, immediately as you begin your review, maybe that's adequate. But I think we need to try that and refine it over time.
Mm-hmm. I like that idea. Dr. Byron?
I'm not sure if I'm the only one who uses that review tool that we have in our drive, but I'm wondering if we want to update that to add some of the administrative pieces that we should be looking at, just that we're all, at least for me as a newbie, making sure I'm hitting all the checks and balances to make sure I'm looking at all those items. So I still use that tool. That's from the folder to make sure I'm tracking everything correctly. But right now it doesn't have the notes for the admin piece. So I'd be happy to update it. I just don't want to leave anything off.
And Madam Chair, Dr. Byra, maybe what we do is, you know, that is page one of an application, or, you know, it's present, you know, for your application. And if it's filled out, you know, with, as a fillable PDF, then you can see that it was Ms. Malice, you know, who identified whatever the issue was. And then you're free, of course, you know, to, adjacent to that, put your own, observations or comments, you know, next to that. But, maybe for consistency purposes, so you're not tracking it across, you know, multiple documents, we just capture it in the same document. That's, I mean, it's a review tool. So we can try that and see how that works.
That sounds good.
Okay. Well, I'm sure that Ms. Malice's inbox will shrink dramatically as a result of, you know, not assuming by herself the responsibility of, you know, trying to get, trying to make corrections that, you know, in some cases that's not, that's easily achieved. In too many cases, it just warrants too much, you know, communication back and forth. And that's what's delaying everyone. And, you know, I haven't forgotten the point that Dr. Davey made, which is, you know, when, applicants with clean applications are forced to wait, you know, that's an unfortunate, outcome, of us, of our process. So anyway, she'll have more capacity. I'm quite confident, for everyone's benefit.
Do we need to engage in any motion making for this process? Okay. I see Ms. Galvin shaking her head. No. All right. Well, then we will get a last code word from Ms. Malice.
Thanks, Madam Chair. The last code word, it's 1894. It's the year 1894.
Well, then we will move on to the last agenda item, which is adjournment. Is there a motion? Anybody?
Make a motion to adjourn.
Okay. Is there a second?
Second.
The motion has been made by Dr. Raitz. It has been seconded by Dr. Stenhoff. It was applauded by Dr. Byra. Is there any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed, nay. The motion carries. Everyone have a wonderful holiday weekend.